You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the September 14th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phone to get your takes on the world, one of which happened last month. Well, last week was a busy one for President Obama and worth paying more attention to than the antics of the two leading presidential candidates, since even after his 8 years in office, some people remain confused about who he is and, as he likes to say, who we are as a people. First, you no doubt heard or read about President Obama being rudely treated on arrival at the Beijing airport for the G20 summit and is being insulted by the new president of the Philippines. What I found more interesting was the Malaysian student at a youth conference in Laos, broadcast on C-SPAN, who expressed her solidarity with the indigenous people defending their ancestral land in North Dakota, who asked the president what he was doing to help them. That question attracted a round of applause from her fellow students and may have been what forced the president and the U.S. media to begin paying attention to the protest of the Sioux Nation's Standing Rock in North Dakota against the building of an oil pipeline under their sacred lands, which would threaten their only source of water. Despite the arrival of thousands of Native and non-Native American supporters from across the U.S. and Canada, there had been not a word from the president or the two major party presidential candidates vying to succeed him, nor apparently had they been asked about the protest that has been ongoing since April, which tells you as much about the U.S. media as it does about Obama, Clinton, and Trump. The Green Party candidates Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka, however, visited the protest site, and after expressing their solidarity, Stein wrote, "I approve this message on the side of one of the pipeline company's bulldozers." That was enough to earn Stein and her running mate, Ajamu Baraka, arrest warrants for their criminal mischief from a corporation-friendly North Dakota judge. But I want to focus on Obama. "That's a great question," enthusiastically responded to the Malaysian student, but it was evident he knew nothing about it. To cover up his ignorance or indifference, he started bragging about what his administration had done for Native Americans before finally admitting, quote, "I can't give you the details on this particular case. I'd have to get back to my staff and see how we're doing on this one," end quote. The Malaysian student's question may have helped to temporarily save the day for the Standing Rock Sioux and their allies. On Friday, after federal judge James Boasberg ruled against the Sioux's appeal for restraining orders, stating that the 1,200-mile oil pipeline project could continue, the Department of Justice and the Army, etc., tiptoed in, asking the oil pipeline company to voluntarily cease construction pending, quote, "serious discussion on whether there should be a nationwide reform with respect to considering tribes' views on these types of infrastructure projects," end quote. Recalling their long experience with the federal government, the Sioux protests and the encampments of their supporters will continue on the site. Well, now what is needed is an intrepid reporter among those approved for presidential press conferences when he has them, who would ask President Obama to justify Washington's material, intelligence, and political support for Saudi Arabia's unrelenting and barbaric air war on the people of Yemen and his decision announced last month to sell the oil monarchy another $1.15 billion in weapons to continue that war. That's on top of the $115 billion the Obama administration has already sold to the Saudis since the Nobel Peace Prize winner came into office. On Monday, Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul and Connecticut Democrat Chris Murphy introduced SJ Res 39 as a joint resolution intended to block the latest deal. Paul said a sale like this, quote, "to a country with poor human rights record, embroiled in a bitter war, is a recipe for disaster and an escalation of an ongoing arms race in the region," end quote. That only hints at the problem. Today at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Harper's Washington editor Andrew Coburn about his article in the current edition of the magazine entitled "Acceptable Losses, Aiding and Abetting the Saudi Slaughter in Yemen." So stay tuned for that. Let's get back to President Obama and his trip to Laos. Since we have no Lewis Carroll or Jonathan Swift to interpret that extraordinary visit or the times we live in, we are left with the output of New York Times reporters. Quote, in a recent briefing with reporters, writes Max Fisher in a news section column he writes called The Interpreter. Susan Rice, the president's national security advisor, said, quote, "A hallmark of the president's tenure has been to face and acknowledge our history," end quote. That history, she said, has included, quote, points of departure from the United States, quote, "overwhelmingly positive role in the world. Where that's the case, we should acknowledge it." This practice, she added, serves our interests and our relationships and our ability to move beyond the past in some of these places, end quote. What America will never do, she failed to say, is apologize or pay reparations for its war crimes. When President Obama became the first American president to visit Hiroshima this past summer, he kept to that policy. He said, 71 years ago, on a bright, cloudless morning, death fell from the sky and the world was changed. A flash of light in the wall of fire destroyed a city and demonstrated that mankind possessed the means to destroy itself, end quote. Not exactly, Mr. President. It was to demonstrate the United States had such a weapon and the means to destroy any country that might challenge it. Well, why do we come to this place, to Hiroshima, Obama asked rhetorically. We come to ponder a terrible force unleashed in a not-so-distant past. We come to mourn the dead, including over 100,000 Japanese men, women, and children, thousands of Koreans, and a dozen Americans held prisoner. Their souls speak to us, he said. They ask us to look inward to take stock of who we are and what we might become, end quote. Well, if they do that, Mr. President, might they not also expect the country responsible, which you represent, to say we are sorry for having caused that disaster? But of course he could not, and should not have apologized, said those who wrapped themselves in the flag. The Japanese, they said, should have thought about the likely consequences of attacking the United States. Well, a side note, Pearl Harbor in Hawaii was not part of the continental United States, but an independent island nation taken by military force from its indigenous inhabitants in 1893, as was the rest of America, and like the rest of America, done without apology. Okay, if one grants that the Japanese were the aggressors in 1941, and thus not meriting an apology from Uncle Sam, what should an American president say about the U.S. so-called secret war in Laos? Not a secret from anyone but Americans, of course. Certainly not from the Laotians and their neighbors in the region who are also getting bombed. This is in part what Obama said to those who heard him in the country's capital, Vientiane, last week, a careful skirting of as much truth and responsibility as he could get away with. Well, I realize, he said, having a U.S. president in Laos would never have once been imaginable. 6 decades ago, this country fell in the Civil War. And as the fighting raged next door in Vietnam, your neighbors and foreign powers, including the United States, intervened here, so said Obama. Not including the United States, Mr. President, the foreign power was the United States. Well, at the time, he continued, the U.S. government did not acknowledge America's role. It was a secret war, and for years the American people did not know. Even now, many Americans are not fully aware of this chapter in our history and supporting that we remember today, end quote. Who do you mean by we? If the president wanted Americans to remember, let alone care about that war, this speech should have been given from the White House on U.S. television, not across the ocean to those who know what happened and which those who lived through it cannot forget. Well, back to Obama. Over 9 years, from 1964 to 1973, he continued, the United States dropped more than 2 million tons of bombs here in Laos, more than we dropped on Germany and Japan combined during all of World War II. It made Laos, per person, the most heavily bombed country in history. As one Laotian said, the bombs fell like rain. Villages and entire valleys were obliterated. The ancient plain of Jars was devastated. Countless civilians were killed. And that conflict, he said, was another reminder that whatever the cause, whatever our intentions, war inflicts a terrible toll, especially on innocent men, women, and children, end quote. Well, today, he says, I stand with you in acknowledging the suffering and sacrifices on all sides of that conflict, end quote. No, Mr. President, war did not inflict the terrible toll. The United States Air Force did that, and acknowledging the suffering and sacrifices on all sides was not nearly enough since it was not nearly equal. You needed to say we were wrong, that as the President of the United States, the country's government and armed forces were wholly responsible for these terrible war crimes against the people who had never harmed or threatened us, that you were sorry. But the President has still more to say. Our new partnership, he said, will continue to deal with a painful legacy of war. And on behalf of the American people, especially our veterans and military families, I want to thank the government and people of Laos for your humanitarian cooperation as we work together to account for Americans missing in action. And I'm pleased that, as a result of this visit, we will increase our efforts and bring more of our missing home to their families in America. I also know that the remnants of war continues to shatter lives here in Laos. Many of the bombs that were dropped were never exploded. Over the years, thousands of Laotians, he said, have been killed or injured, farmers tending their fields, children playing. The wounds, a missing leg or arm, last a lifetime. And that's why, as president, I've dramatically increased our funding to help remove these unexploded bombs. As a result, Laos is clearing more bombs. Fewer Laotians are being hurt or killed. And together we are saving lives. But there's still much more work to do, said the president. So today I'm proud to announce a historic increase in these efforts. The United States will double our annual funding to $90 million over the next 3 years to help Laos expand its work. Words from those attending, according to the White House. This will help Laos expand its work to remove even more bombs, allow Laotians to farm more land, and increase support for victims. I'll bear witness to this work tomorrow when I meet with survivors. Given our history here, I believe the United States has a moral obligation to help Laos heal. And even as we continue to deal with the past, our new partnership is focused on the future, end quote. Increase to $90 million over 3 years, while Israel alone gets $8 million a day, and in a deal signed today, it will get $38 billion over 10 years and $12 billion at the same time Laos is getting its $90 million. Mr. Obama, have you no sense of shame, no sense of decency, no need to do what's right? Of course not. That's why Wall Street, the weapons manufacturers in Israel lobby selected him to be president, to put a human-friendly mask on U.S. imperialism, and he keeps fooling a lot of people. And what he offered a country that should have received many billions of reparations over the passing years was what they call on the street chump change. What the multinational corporations' traveling salesman speech was really about was reserved for the end. We believe in prosperity, he said, that is shared and reduces poverty and inequality by lifting up the many and not just a few wealthy people at the top. Rather than simply extracting another country's natural resources, we believe development has to invest in people, in their education, and in their skills. We believe, said Obama, that trade should be free and truly fair, and that workers and the environment should be protected. And that's the kind of development and the kind of trade that we seek. That's why, he said, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is so important, not only because TPP countries, including the United States, will be able to sell more goods to each other, but it also has important strategic benefits. TPP is a core pillar of America's rebalance to the Asia-Pacific. And the trade, he said, and the growth it supports will reinforce America's security alliances and regional partnerships. It will build greater integration and trust across this region. And I have said before, said the president, and I will say again, failure to move ahead with TPP would not just have economic consequences, but would call into question America's leadership in this vital region, end quote. That is as good a reason as any to oppose it, I would say, since what almost everything America has done in and to that region since the end of World War II is a disaster, and that has been true under Obama's administration as much as it was under those who preceded him. And you could say the same for the Middle East, Latin America, and Africa. At Hiroshima, Obama had also said, "We may not be able to eliminate man's capacity to do evil, so nations and the alliances that we form must possess the means to defend themselves. But among those nations, like my own," he said, "that hold nuclear stockpiles, we must have the courage to escape the logic of fear and pursue a world without them. We may not realize this goal in my lifetime, but persistent effort can roll back the possibility of catastrophe. We can chart a course that leads to the destruction of these stockpiles," end quote. Not only has President Obama made fewer moves in that direction than any president before him, Earlier this year, he committed the country to a multi-year program to upgrade America's nuclear arsenal that is estimated to cost $1 trillion, which will include the development of a cruise missile capable of carrying a nuclear or conventional warhead. What Obama plans to leave as his legacy are 1,000 new missiles with adjustable nuclear capacities, 100 new long-range bombers, and a new fleet of nuclear-armed submarines. Most depressing, wrote award-winning journalist John Kinzer in the Boston Globe back in January, is that, quote, the proposal for this investment comes from a president who campaigned on a pledge to reduce and seek to eliminate nuclear weapons and who won a Nobel Prize for his apparent sincerity. Apparent it was. It's high time that the people of the world demand that President Obama give back that prize. And that's been my way of putting in perspective the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon in September 2001, 15 years later.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
تمتطي قوساق زحف طفلة تمتطي قوساق زحف.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we focus on the growing power of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. In a few minutes, we will hear from the key spokesperson for that movement, Omar Barghouti. But first, we want to take a look at how support for the movement is spreading into significant communities of color as they recognize the relationship of their struggle to that of the Palestinians. I want to begin this exploration by reading from an article by Columbia University professor Hamid Dabishi, who is professor of Iranian studies and comparative literature. He writes, "Two significant public events came together in late August to turn this season of morbid political despair in the United States presidential election to highlight a far more significant social movement, otherwise hidden to the outside world. One was when the American football team San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick refused to stand for the national anthem before games because he said the U.S. oppresses African Americans and other minorities. The other was when the widely popular pop singer Beyoncé brought a few mothers of police violence victims to the MTA Video Music Awards ceremony as her special guest. These two public events are predicated on a much deeper and more enduring development in the U.S. known as Black Lives Matter, a grassroots civil rights movement that originated in the African-American community campaigning against systematic violence and racism towards black people. Black Lives Movement began in 2013 after the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the shooting death of African-American teenager Trayvon Martin and increasingly assumed national significance following the 2014 deaths of two African Americans, Michael Brown in Ferguson and Eric Garner in New York. Now, in a significant manifesto published on August 1st, the Movement for Black Lives a coalition of more than 60 organizations, has pushed the Black Lives Movement forward and issued a comprehensive program of action, which consists of 6 demands aimed at ending all forms of violence and injustice endured by black people, redirecting resources from prisons and the military to education, health, and safety, creating a just, democratically controlled economy, and securing black political power within a genuinely inclusive democracy. Backing the demands are 40 separate proposals and 34 policy briefs, replete with data, context, and legislative recommendations. Progressive forces now gathered around this noble movement for the dignity of black lives and beyond are in fact late in joining the rest of the civilized world denouncing the systematic violence at the core of the Israeli settler colony. Among the declarations of the movement for black lives is the most unambiguous position of the movement on the question of Palestinian national liberation, denouncing the U.S. government for its unconditional support for the Israeli settler colony. The U.S. justifies and advances the global war on terror, the document declared, via its alliance with Israel and is complicit in the genocide taking place against the Palestinian people. In an equally significant statement, the manifesto declared its support for the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement and condemned the Zionist-led campaign against it. Fight the expanding number of anti-BDS bills passed in states around the country. This type of legislation not only harms the movement to end the Israeli occupation of Palestine, but is a threat to the unconstitutional right to free speech and protest. Needless to say, such a brave, bold, and unequivocal declaration in solidarity with the Palestinian cause by a robust national movement in the U.S. has rubbed the Zionists the wrong way. At home in their settler colony in Israel, or else commuting to their imperial habitat in the U.S., they are now furious with this statement and have launched a concerted assault on it to make it controversial. Making this aspect of the Movement for Black Lives Declaration controversial, and thus by extension the whole movement controversial, is the key strategy now launched by Zionists to discredit their entire project. In other words, the Movement for Black Lives must either embrace the Zionist colonization of Palestine as all good and dandy, or else it is controversial and must be discredited. This is how self-delusional these Zionists are. There is, however, absolutely nothing controversial about calling the settler colony for the racist apartheid state that it is. Nothing controversial to call the systematic annihilation of Palestinians a genocide. And nothing controversial about joining the global solidarity movement of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. If anything, progressive forces now gathered around this noble movement for the dignity of black lives and beyond are in fact late in joining the rest of the civilized world denouncing the systematic violence at the core of the Israeli settler colony. By fabricating this non-existent controversy about this historic document, the Zionists are also muddying the waters to pollute a global recognition of its world historic significance. The most significant civil rights movement of the 21st century in the U.S. has solidly sided with the Palestinian National Liberation, denounced the Israeli killings of Palestinians, endorsed the nonviolent civil disobedience of BDS, and with the stroke of one historic manifesto, rendered the entire Israeli propaganda machinery obsolete. This is the fact that the Israeli propaganda network cannot fathom or allow to happen, for they think they own the U.S. Historically, there has been an ideological division of labor between hardcore Zionists who are violently engaged in stealing Palestine and slaughtering Palestinians, while their liberal contingency has offered a false, caring image vis-a-vis progressive movements in the U.S. That sham is no longer working. A courageous, principled, and globally informed generation of civil rights uprisings has now picked up where the civil rights movement of the 1960s left behind. Among the ranks of this generation are liberated post-Zionist Jews, shoulder to shoulder with the younger generation of Muslim immigrants who denounce Islamic violence, Christians who oppose the U.S. Christian imperialism, and equally principled people who no longer identify with any religion at all. Rooted in the black suffering in the U.S., but reaching far out and wide into the larger communities and counties around the globe, the movement for black lives can no longer be racially profiled or subjected to propaganda and disinformation. The Israeli propaganda machinery has successfully convinced itself and its Zionist supporters worldwide that any Palestinians who resist the colonization and theft of their homeland are terrorists, precisely on the blueprint that today white supremacist racists in the United States are outraged against the movement for black lives. The historic solidarity between these two movements is all but inevitable, and its leaders are not the corrupt U.S. politicians that AIPAC can buy and recruit to support one of the most vicious legacies of European colonialism, now sustained by U.S. militarism in the heart of the Arab and Muslim world. That was an article by Columbia University professor Hamad Dabishi, linking the Palestinian struggle to the Black Lives Matter movement. Israel is not taking this lying down. They've organized their propaganda machine to fight back against the BDS onslaught. Here is an article from the Israeli newspaper Mariv, which makes that very point. A veteran Israeli intelligence analyst is linking recent attacks and harassment campaigns against Palestinian activists and human rights organizations to so-called black ops by Israel's intelligence agencies. Writing in Mariv, Yossi Melman, who has covered Israel's spy agencies for decades, reveals telling details about Israel's ramped-up fight against the Palestinian-led boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. The fight is being led by Gilad Erdan, Israel's Minister of Strategic Affairs. According to Melman, Erdan's ministry is gearing up to face BDS as if it were a military challenge. We want most of the ministry's work to be classified, its Director General Seema Vaknin-Gil recently told the Transparency Committee of Israel's parliament, the Knesset. There are many sensitivities, and I can't even explain in an open forum why there are such sensitivities, Vaknin-Gil said. A major part of what we do stays under the radar. According to Melman, the ministry has recently hired 25 workers whose names are classified. It has an intelligence section run by a former security services operative and receives assistance from a special unit within Israel military intelligence and from the Shin Bet secret police. This report from Israel's state broadcaster, subtitled in English by activist Ronnie Barkin, shows Vaknin-Gil vowing to defeat the BDS movement in her testimony to the Knesset committee. It also shows the committee's chair, Stav Shafir, complaining that the government is revealing almost nothing about how it is spending the huge sums allocated to the anti-BDS effort. Among the ministry's activities are what Melman terms special operations or black ops, which may include a defamation campaign, harassment, and threats to the lives of activists, as well as infringing on and violating their privacy. In this context, Bellman points to recent attacks on the websites of the Palestinian BDS National Committee and other organizations supporting Palestinian rights. Bellman likens Israel's anti-BDS operations to assassinations. He says that Strategic Affairs Ministry officials are likening the effort to crush the movement to the struggle against terror. In April, for instance, Israel refused to renew the travel permit of Omar Barghouti, the Palestinian human rights defender and co-founder of the BDS movement. The effective travel ban followed threats against Barghouti and other Palestinian human rights defenders by top Israeli government ministers, including Erdogan, and intelligence minister Yisrael Katz, who called for targeted civil eliminations of BDS leaders with the help of Israeli intelligence. The Hebrew term Katz used was similar to the Israeli term for targeted assassinations. At the time, Amnesty International strongly condemned these threats, warning that an escalation of acts of intimidation by the government and attacks and threats by settlers and other non-state actors have created an increasingly dangerous environment for human rights defenders in Israel and the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. And last month, Israel announced efforts to root out and expel foreign nationals suspected of being involved in the nonviolent movement for Palestinian rights. It also appears that Israel is hoping to recruit Palestinian citizens of Israel to the effort. Last week, the Nazareth-based Arabic newspaper Al Sanara published an advertisement from the civil administration. The name Israel gives to the military bureaucracy that rules over millions of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. Images of the ad were posted on a Facebook page whose administrators identified themselves as Palestinian citizens of Israel who support BDS. The ad seeks Arabic speakers and consultants to collect information from various primary and secondary sources, including newspapers and websites, but with an emphasis on social networks. The information would relate to incitement to violence and hatred and the development of BDS initiatives. Journalists and activists should remain vigilant about their use of social networks and should practice good digital security. The Electronic Intifada recently published a guide to online security for activists. Bellman also confirms that Israel has strongly supported the push for legislation stigmatizing or curtailing the BDS movement in various Western countries. It also uses proxies to achieve its aims. The ministry also initiates pressure or leveraging actions to convince international companies not to boycott Israel. This involves the use of AIPAC and Hillel in the United States or similar groups in other countries. This type of activity also has a certain sensitivity because it involves foreign government, Israel, trying to act and influence organizations and individuals in other countries, Bellman wrote. Another form of influence he outlines, albeit one already well known, is Israel's effort to use public relations or hasbara to influence international opinion. In this regard, he reveals that the Strategic Affairs Ministry is spending large sums to fund visits for what it calls opinion leaders, journalists, bloggers, actors, and trade union leaders to Israel. The only thing the ministry has not apparently considered is ending Israel's regime of occupation, apartheid, and settler colonialism, and restoring Palestinian rights. That would be the swiftest way to bring an end to BDS. That was an article from the Israeli newspaper Ma'ariv documenting the pushback against the BDS movement by Israel. And now on to our feature presentation this morning, a speech by BDS's major voice to the world, Omar Barghouti. It was to be presented at Stanford University in person, but as we heard, Israel has suspended Barghouti's travel permits in an effort to silence him. So the presentation was via Skype. Here is Omar Barghouti.
Greetings from Palestine. I'm happy to be speaking for the first time at Stanford, while not being at Stanford physically, due to the travel ban imposed on me by the Israeli authorities, effectively. But I shall address you even from afar, and my words will reach you regardless of their bans. I'll talk about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement for Palestinian rights, and Israel's main response to this movement in the last couple of years, which is fostering an environment of McCarthyism. I will first address the roots of the BDS movement, what we're calling for, what we've done in the last 10 years to make Israel's regime of oppression so concerned, and to threaten us as a result. The Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, or BDS movement, was established by the absolute majority of Palestinian civil society in 2005. By that we mean political parties, trade union movements, women's movements, farmers, academics, writers, students, youth, and so on and so forth, among Palestinians in historic Palestine, as well as Palestinians in exile, including the large refugee community. So BDS calls for the three basic rights without which Palestinians cannot exercise our inalienable right to self-determination. Those three rights are an end to the occupation of 1967, which includes the wall and the colonies that Israel has illegally established in the occupied Palestinian territory, as well as occupied Syrian territory, of course. Number two, ending Israel's system of racial discrimination, which amounts to apartheid by the UN definition of the term apartheid. And third and foremost, the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes of origin from which they were ethnically cleansed systematically during the Nakba, the violent establishment of the State of Israel on top of the ruins of Palestinian society. The reason why we're calling for all three of these rights and not just ending the occupation, which is more understood, especially in the United States, is because we do not shape our rights according to what's convenient to any audience. Those are our rights, our inherent rights as a people under international law. Second, because the Palestinian people are made up of three main constituencies, if you will. The largest is Palestinians in exile, as well as the Palestinian refugee community, whether inside Palestine or outside. Together, they constitute 68% of the Palestinian people are refugees, again, inside and outside. But if we go into the geographic divisions, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, including East Jerusalem, are 38% of the Palestinian people. Palestinians who are citizens of the present-day State of Israel are 12%, and 50% of the Palestinians are in exile, not allowed to go home simply because they're the wrong type. As a human rights movement that is anchored in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and international law precepts, we advocate the basic rights of all Palestinians, and this is a movement that's built on the premise that all Palestinians, whether in historic Palestine or in exile, are entitled by law and by ethical principles, obviously, to participate in the right to self-determination. It's not, we cannot reduce the Palestinian people only to those in the West Bank and Gaza, as the Oslo Agreement has attempted to do. To achieve those three basic rights, ending the occupation, ending apartheid, and the right of return, BDS adopted strategies and tactics that evolved from decades of Palestinian popular resistance, as well as they were inspired by the South African anti-apartheid movement, very deeply inspired by that movement, and the U.S. civil rights movement. To achieve those three rights under international law, we've called for isolating Israel's regime of occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid academically, culturally, economically, financially, militarily, and so on, as was done against the apartheid regime in South Africa. Since 2005 to the present day, 10 and almost 11 years, BDS has achieved quite a lot more than we had initially anticipated when we launched the movement in 2005. There are many reasons for that, but one important point to remember is that in comparison to the South African boycott, the boycott against South African apartheid, we are going much, much faster. Archbishop Desmond Tutu and others have commented on the pace of growth and growth of the impact of the BDS movement. Part of it has to do with learning the lessons of the South African example, the case in South Africa. Another has to do with technology, the internet, social media, and so on, the advent of which they did not have in South Africa. There are many other factors, including the centrality of Israel in the Western discourse, the protection Israel gets from the United States government and Western Europe, and so on. Regardless, BDS has been growing at a very, very quick rate, despite the massive obstacles that are on its path to freedom, justice, and equality for the Palestinian people. I'll talk a bit about some of the successes we've had, reaching to the last couple of years and the dramatic shift in Israel's attitude towards the BDS movement. After several years of achieving academic successes, the cultural successes, with artists canceling performances in Tel Aviv looking increasingly like Sun City, the resort that was boycotted by most decent artists during apartheid South Africa, Tel Aviv today is the Sun City of yesterday. So increasingly, a number of artists and bands are looking at Tel Aviv that way. Academics around the world, especially in the United States, with many academic associations, have started to adopt the academic boycott of Israel, which is an institutional boycott that targets institutions rather than individuals. Because BDS is based on isolating a regime of oppression because it's oppressing us and denying us our rights, not based on identity. So our movement is based on complicity, not identity, if you will. We couldn't care less about the identity of the oppressor so long as they are oppressing us. So the Asian American Studies Association, American Studies Association, National Women's Studies, Indigenous Studies, African Literature, and hopefully the American Anthropological Association will vote for the academic boycott resolution as the voting is happening now. This is a growing movement among academics in the US, among academics in South Africa, Brazil, Britain, Ireland, and elsewhere, among artists as well. But Israel initially dismissed all those successes as a nuisance. This cannot impact such a powerful regime as Israel's, with its nuclear weapons and massive arsenal, military arsenal, and enormous U.S. support, billions of dollars of your tax money supporting this regime of oppression. So why should Israel worry about a human rights, nonviolent movement led by Palestinians that is affecting some artists, bands, and academics here and there? That was their initial reaction, although while saying that, they launched the Brand Israel campaign in 2005, less than a year after the Palestinian campaign for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel was established. So clearly they felt the danger, but not yet at the level that they see it today. That is a danger to a regime of oppression. The Brand Israel campaign was established to present Israel's image as a liberal democratic state with advanced technology and vivid society and so on and so forth, basically whitewashing or covering up Israel's oppression and denial of Palestinian rights. It takes many forms, pinkwashing, greenwashing, all kinds of washing, using gay rights, environmental issues and other aspects to cover up its regime of oppression. Whatever washing Israel does, one thing is for sure, there's a lot of dirty laundry to be washed. That is Israel's record of crimes and criminality against the people of Palestine. But since 2013, Israel started to change its tone about the BDS movement. It started to see an impact on its economy for the first time. So we started to see very large corporations considering pulling out of the Israeli economy because of their involvement in projects that violate international law. And Israel started to see pension funds in Europe, increasingly in the US as well, pulling their investments out of companies that are involved in Israel's occupation and violations of Palestinian rights. Then this shift from the largely quote-unquote symbolic impact of BDS in the academic and cultural sphere, possibly some sporting sphere as well, into the economic sphere, the impact in the economic sphere, alarmed the establishment in Israel, the government, the intelligentsia, and so on. So as of 2013, they started to view BDS as, quote, a strategic threat. Again, a threat to what? And we'll get to that point in a minute. But since 2013, we started to see some impact, very clear impact on the economy. I'll just give a few examples for you to get an idea. The second largest pension fund in the Netherlands, PGGM, in 2014 pulled all its investments from the top five Israeli banks because of their involvement in Israel's illegal occupation and settlements. So did the Luxembourg Sovereign Fund. And most recently, the United Methodist Church pulled its investments in Israeli banks and put all Israeli banks on a no investment list, which was an extremely important turning point for the United Methodist Church pension fund. We also saw in 2014 the Presbyterian Church divest from HP, Caterpillar, and Motorola Solutions, and endorse a boycott of Israeli settlement goods. United Church of Christ followed suit, and several other church denominations in the US started to adopt similar language, as well as some churches in Canada. This is growing. This divestment from companies involved in the occupation has grown a lot. We also started to see some major corporations like Veolia, the large French corporation that's involved in water, sewage, transportation, and other areas. After 7 years of campaigning against Veolia, which we launched in November 2008, in September 2015, Veolia pulled out entirely from the Israeli market, where it was involved in several projects that completely and very obviously violate international law. So Veolia lost billions of dollars worth of tenders and contracts in Sweden, the United Kingdom, Norway, the United States, Kuwait, and other countries until it reached that decision that it was not worth it. And this is a very important point. For those large corporations that are starting to pull out of Israel, they never say we're pulling out because of BDS. They say, oh, we pulled out because of financial considerations. Duh, exactly. That's what BDS does. We make it untenable for you to continue profiting from denying our rights, from violating our rights. We hurt your bottom line so that you stop being complicit in Israel's violations of our rights. That's exactly how the logic of BDS works. So it is financial, obviously. After Veolia, we saw Orange, the massive telecommunications corporation, pull out of the Israeli market as well by ending its relationship with an Israeli company, Partner Communications, that is involved in settlements. We also saw CRH, the largest building materials company in Ireland, pull out its investments from Israel. And lately, G4S, the largest security company in the world, announced that it would leave Israel within 12 to 24 months. But major corporations are major liars. We never trust them. We continue campaigning until we actually see the back of their door, seeing their backs going out of the door. So we shall continue campaigning against G4S until it ends actually on the ground its involvement. And even then, we shall continue to support other campaigners against G4S, because G4S does not just violate Palestinian rights. It violates Black and Latino rights in the United States, with its detention centers of immigrants, of asylum seekers in the United States, in Europe, in many countries, South Africa, and many countries around the world, G4S is known, has a reputation for violating human rights and international law in all these countries. So building on the intersectionality that exists, the common understanding of a common enemy, and building organic relationships of common solidarity with various groups makes it incumbent upon us, even after some of those companies abandon the Israeli market and end their involvement in violating our rights, we shall continue to work with groups like Black Lives Matter, Dream Defenders, and the various Latino and Chicano groups in the United States to fight G4S, to fight for their rights against those large corporations that are profiting from denying rights to the various communities around the world. But going back to the economic impact of BDS, with all these pension funds divesting, banks in Europe pulling out of relations with Israeli banks, and so on and so forth, we started to see a real impact. A United Nations report in 2015 revealed that foreign direct investment in the Israeli economy in 2014 plummeted in comparison to 2013 by about 46%. That's almost half of the foreign direct investment dropped between 2013 to 2014. This is extremely significant because Israel's economy relies tremendously on foreign investment. One of the co-authors of that UN report, who happens to be an Israeli academic, attributed this massive decrease in foreign direct investment in Israel to two factors: Israel's war on Gaza in 2014 and the growth of the boycott movement, as she put it. So with the domino effect of corporations abandoning their illegal projects in Israel and credit agencies like Moody's acknowledging that BDS, if it keeps growing, might have a substantial impact on Israel's economy. Corporations like RAND in the United States coming up with surveys and studies showing that BDS might cost Israel in the next 10 years 1 to 2% of its GDP annually. In 10 years, that amounts to about $28 to $56 billion. That basically offsets the United States' entire aid package to Israel in 10 years. So imagine that. This soft, nonviolent human rights movement that's global and led by Palestinian civil society can affect Israel's economy to the extent that we can offset the entire U.S. aid to Israel, which is the one of the main reasons why Israel's regime of oppression is able to maintain its denial of Palestinian rights. So you can offset the guilt of your tax money being used to support this oppressive system by supporting the BDS movement. That's a very important way to do something about where your tax money is going, and you cannot control where your tax money is going to a large extent. But no resistance comes cheap or for free. There's always a price to be paid, including effective international solidarity with the Palestinian rights, as in the BDS movement in the United States. We're seeing an unprecedented backlash by Israel. Since February 2014, Israel's far-right government, which got even more far-right in 2015's election, decided that because BDS is having such a strategic impact, it is time to change strategies. So it's an admission of failure, basically, that their strategy since 2005 till 2014 failed, and therefore they had to develop a new strategy based on legal warfare, trying to delegitimize BDS from above after having failed to do anything about it from the grassroots level. We're winning hearts and minds, and therefore Israel is resorting to mobilizing its bought politicians, as Thomas Friedman called them, bought and paid for politicians in the United States, in Europe, and elsewhere, mobilizing those to enact legislation to delegitimize BDS from above. That's one aspect of the new strategy, increased intelligence, espionage. So Israel basically told the US and Western Europe, we shall spy on your citizens. And we haven't heard a peep from the US State Department, from Federica Mogherini, the equivalent of Secretary of State of the EU, and so on. The third aspect is more funding for Israel's propaganda campaign, the Brand Israel campaign. Hundreds of millions of dollars are being spent on propaganda, sending Israeli music groups, dance companies, technology experts, academics, completely funded by the state, to, quote, present Israel's prettier face. So people would think about it in positive terms. So it's investing even more in Brand Israel campaigning to counter BDS. But the most alarming part is the legal warfare. And Israel has been investing quite a lot in that in the last couple of years, especially in the last year. Israel, as many of you would know, is trying to pass legislation after legislation in states across the United States, making BDS basically illegitimate, or trying to issue statements, if not laws, that condemn BDS with all sorts of smears and accusations. The most common is that it's an anti-Semitic movement, discriminates against Jews, It seeks the destruction of Israel, which is a U.S. Partner, and so on and so forth. If you look at all these charges and all these smears, it would be so easy for a sixth grader anywhere in the world to refute them, so I don't need to spend a lot of time on that. But Israel does not rely on logic. I mean, they never relied on logic in pushing their agenda in the United States. They rely on buying politicians and their massive propaganda machine in the US media and in Hollywood to an extent. So they don't need to argue. They don't need to debate. In fact, they avoid debate like the plague. They never agree to debate us. Arch-Zionist supporters of Israel and those who oppose Palestinian rights would not agree to debate us easily because they know. If it's logic versus logic, they lose. If it's argument versus argument, they lose. We always win at the grassroots level because it's much easier to defend justice than to defend injustice. It's much easier to advocate equality than to advocate apartheid. So their case is really, really difficult to argue. So they don't need to argue. They push from above. And that's what's fostering a new McCarthyism across the U.S. It's not like the U.S. was this perfect paradise that was perfect democracy and Israel is corrupting it. I do not support that kind of argumentation. You know the U.S. better than I, so I won't go into that. But the U.S. has enough of its own problems in terms of racial justice issues, economic justice, gender justice, the justice for the indigenous people, the native population of the United States, and so on and so forth. But Israel is adding to all that. It's amplifying this McCarthyism. Trying to suppress boycott as illegitimate goes against decades of a very, very long heritage of boycotts in the United States as protected speech, as protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. In fact, the 1982 case of Claiborne Hardware Company against the NAACP ended up with the NAACP asserting its right to boycott Claiborne over its racist policies. And that was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, that boycotts to affect economic, social, and political change are perfectly legitimate free speech that is protected by the U.S. Constitution. That will be Israel's main challenge. If it were to go to court to say a BDS advocate in New York, let's say, should be shunned by the state, should not be contracted, should be blacklisted by the state of New York because she supports BDS, and we go to court, it will reach all the way up to the Supreme Court, we shall win. They have no legal ground to stand on. And that's very important to remember. In more repressive societies in Europe, like France, their case might be a bit easier because it's a very corrupt legal system there, and we don't have time to argue about that. But in the U.S., at least, there's a constitutional protection for free speech that we should use. One of the most important points that Israel argues against BDS with is anti-Semitism, that this is a movement that wants to end Israel as it is, wants to destroy Israel. I think they use that argument, and therefore it's anti-Jewish, it's anti-Semitic. Any boycott of Israel is by definition anti-Jewish and therefore anti-Semitic, and therefore it has to be banned. That's the very simplistic, superficial logic they use. And again, they don't rely on logic. But let's try to unpack that. What Israel is saying is that if you oppose Israeli policies, Israeli apartheid, occupation, colonization, and so on, and you call for effective nonviolent measures to stop that and to assert Palestinian rights under international law, any such accountability measures would, by definition, be anti-Jewish. If you oppose Israel, you're automatically opposing the Jews. And I think this in itself is an anti-Semitic argument, because it equates Israel with the Jews. It puts all Jews in one basket, one monolithic basket, entirely, completely represented by Israel. That is anti-Semitic. Anyone who denies diversity among Jewish communities around the world and puts all Jews in one basket is an anti-Semite. Let's make no mistake about that. So Zionists, when they make those arguments, as Israel, when it makes this argument, they fall into the anti-Semitic trap. So we should reject that out of hand. The second point is that BDS has always consistently been anchored in international law and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and therefore rejects all forms of racism, including anti-Semitism. We're not shy about that. We're very categorical, we're very explicit, and we make it very consistently in all languages across the world. We do not work with anti-Jewish racists or any racists of any type, in fact, because this is a human rights movement that believes in equal rights for all humans, irrespective of identity. That's why Jewish support for BDS is growing tremendously, especially in the United States. One of the Israel lobbies, the soft lobbies, J Street, in 2014 did a poll of Jewish American opinion, and they found out something very interesting. 46% of all non-Orthodox Jewish American men support a full boycott of Israel. That's almost half men under 40, that is. Half Jewish American men under 40 who are non-Orthodox would support a full boycott of Israel. So just imagine this number. Recent polls have shown close to half of the Democratic Party's base would support sanctions or worse against Israel over its occupation and settlement policy. So the mood is changing, the discourse is changing, despite the mainstream media bias, despite the Hollywood bias, despite your politicians being so corrupt and groveling to Israel's interests rather than your interests. Despite that, this movement is growing a lot, with a lot of Jewish support and Black support and Latino and queer women's support, anti-war support, and environmental support, and so on and so forth. If you just look at your own Stanford's student government resolution supporting divestment last year, I believe, the coalition that led that campaign for divestment was just so inspiring. To see such a huge coalition of Asian groups, Latino, Black, queer, Jewish, and so on and so forth, all working with SJP, with Palestinian solidarity groups, to present a divestment resolution. Because people see injustice in Palestine as injustice anywhere else, as they saw injustice in South Africa, and they want to do something about it, especially since their institution, in this case Stanford, is deeply complicit through its academic relations with Israeli universities that are involved, deeply involved in human rights violations and war crimes even, exchange programs, research programs, especially military research programs, and so on and so forth. And its investment fund being invested in companies that perpetuate the denial of Palestinian rights. Because of all that, there's a responsibility for the Stanford community, academics as well as students, to do something to end their institution's complicity in denying Palestinian rights. If you think of it this way, then what comes to mind is Martin Luther King's statement that boycott at a basic level is basically withdrawing support from an evil system, withdrawing cooperation with an evil system. Think about that. That's not heroic. That's a profound moral obligation. So we're not asking you for charity when we say we're appealing to you to support BDS. We're not asking for charity. At a basic level, we're asking you to do your best to end the complicity of your institutions with the regime of occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid that's denying our basic rights. That is a profound moral obligation. To counter Israel's induced McCarthyism and to fight together against all forms of injustice, including racial, economic, social, and other forms of injustice, we've got to stick together because they are sticking together, our enemies, large corporations, the military, security, industries, the oil companies, they're sticking together. They know their interests, and so do we. And it's time we worked together. Thank you.
That was Omar Barghouti speaking at Stanford University. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
So how was the UN's climate change panel chosen, and can we trust them? At the present rate, how many years until the polar ice caps disappear completely? Why are some scientists saying a nuclear war and a nuclear winter that follows it would be good because it would stop global warming? And are there any scientists who are being straight with us rather than in the pocket of one interest group or another? Why are these basic questions about climate change not even asked, let alone answered? And why is the London media keeping us all ignorant? Is it on purpose? Plus, Hillary Clinton's health. Is it really pneumonia? Her coughing fits have been happening all year. Why isn't Bernie Sanders being selected and suggested to take over from her if she drops out of the US presidential race? And taking no chances, how Israel stole the atomic bomb from the US and had them in place in 1966, ready to go, an entire year before the Six-Day War, where the IDF kicked Egyptian, Syrian and Jordanian forces out of East Jerusalem and stole the occupied territories from the Palestinians to make a so-called buffer zone. Plus, China's territorial dispute with the US-backed Philippines, where their president Duterte this week is accused of running death squads in his country, as well as himself actually murdering his opponents. Our sister show Dialects back at noon every Tuesday. This week, full interviews with the Swiss-German investment banker Manfred Petrisch, who's one of his colleagues was 9/11, actually on the site at 9/11 and used to visit the World Trade Center regularly. Fascinating to hear his views of what's happened since as well, the fallout. But we start this week, very pleased to welcome to the studio from Oslo, Norway, Torstein Vidal. Hi, Torstein. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Donny. Good to be back.
You were here actually maybe a couple of years ago, was it? Maybe even 3 years ago, talking about the trial of Anders Breivik. So let's just briefly reprise that before we get into this climate stuff. I mean, I was quite amazed at the article you wrote there that Breivik is conflating Zionism with Nazism. And one of the things you wrote particularly stood out to me, and that was that actually you had some sympathy for Breivik in that he was saying that there wasn't any proper democracy in Norway and no proper freedom of speech.
Yeah, I was mostly just referring from his trial, his defense speech in that article. But I don't want to hear that I was sympathetic to his ideas. It's just he made one point during his defense speech, and that was he felt that the far right in Norway wasn't included properly in the democratic process, and so Well, obviously, he felt he had to do something outside of the process.
Outside of the system. Also, I mean, he was using this term in his manifesto quite a lot, this term counter-jihad as much as possible rather than Zionism. And do you think that, you know, there was elements of Zionist to his ideas, his ideology? He obviously had a belief system, almost like a kind of religion. I know he was a Freemason, for example, that he wanted to sort of perpetrate through these attacks.
Well, I don't. I haven't studied this Anders Breivik in detail, so I more like looked at the whole event itself and how the police were reluctant to stop him and that kind of thing.
Because there was, I mean, he actually drove all the way to the Utoya Island after blowing this bomb up, and he wasn't pursued by the police. And I don't want to get too much into this, but one of the things that does seem important is if you can, and it does seem Breivik was both a Zionist and a Nazi at the same time.
I'm not sure about that. What he said in court was that he wanted to include the Nazis into his kind of in-group or something. He wanted to basically to have a bigger reach. So I think he just basically wanted to increase his following. Or
so perhaps anybody that would join him, he was interested in talking to. Anyway, look,
yeah,
let's get on and talk about what you're here to discuss this week, and that is the giant ice cube, really. I mean, this is the way I see it, is that every time you've got a drink with ice in it, this is a little model of climate change, because it's all very well, your drink is fine, all the time that ice is still there, and as soon as that ice finishes melting, suddenly the temperature of your drink, and this is all very important to us all, folks, the temperature of your drink starts to go up at quite a rate. I mean, the ice really is a moderator of the temperature, and whilst it's disappearing, nobody really noticed much of a change. So I suppose the ultimate question is, how long do you think we've got until the ice disappears entirely? Because it certainly is disappearing.
Well, the debate is really about when will the ice disappear completely for one day or just a short while every
you
summer?
You mean absolutely no ice. So the Arctic Circle would just be disappeared. So there would be just, I think it's in its sea underneath the Arctic. It would just become sea.
Basically. It's called a blue ocean event. Yeah.
Okay, so when is that going to happen, do you think, if you're looking at the projections?
Well, according to Peter Wadhams, the Cambridge professor of oceanography for 40 years, it's about now. It's like 2016 plus or minus.
Yeah, but it hasn't happened, has it?
It doesn't happen, but it's, you know, every year you have different weather in the Arctic and around the world. And when the data and the trend line goes down to about 2016 plus or minus 3 years, that means it's this year or next year, basically.
So what's the latest, anyway? Because you have a summer melt season, what's the latest news on this?
Well, this year, 2016, has been exceptional in so many ways. And it's the lowest ever for two-dimensional sea ice extent and ice area, when averaged from January to September, or even from last September to this September. And also, most likely, the record low for January to December. So it's pretty darn low, although maybe not lowest ever for the absolute lowest day of the year, which is in mid-September.
Okay, are there any estimates for which the Arctic will be ice-free? I mean, we've sort of mentioned that, haven't we? Farewell to ice. Peter Wadhams, I mean, you seem to be citing him quite a lot. Is there any evidence that he is just an honest scientist and he's not backed by anybody? Why do you talk about Wadhams?
Well, Peter Wadhams, he released his book A Farewell to Ice, which is sort of the end of his research career in the Arctic and Antarctic this summer. And he's talking in the book about the end of ice as we know it, basically. And in the sense that the Arctic used to have sea ice every day of the year, and now the data for ice volume showed a trend for at least one ice-free day starting as I said, just about 2016.
Something happened this year, I believe, where the ships are actually making their way across what was originally icy seas, so they wouldn't be able to get through, or maybe you'd have to send an icebreaker through. And I believe we're now expecting a ship back to Bristol, which is some kind of, am I right, a sailing ship, which is making its way through there without not a proper icebreaker, which will be coming back to Bristol soon. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think it's a yacht. I don't know how many feet or anything, but it first traversed the Northern Sea Route, which is along the Siberian coast. And then the other Arctic Passage, which is the Northwest Passage along Alaska and Canada to Greenland. And it's heading for Bristol now, I think it's in the Baffin Bay.
Yeah, so what's the significance of that? Is it because because of the ice melting back that some parts of the year areas of the seas are more accessible than they were before?
Absolutely. And, you know, all the fossil fuel industries are also waiting eagerly to be able to move into the Arctic Ocean to start pumping oil and gas, only to increase the problem of global warming even more.
What about criminal complacency? This is some quote you gave me. This comes from a Cambridge professor. This is Wadham, I guess, again. Arctic sea ice over the last 40 to 50 years. To what extent is this UN Climate Change Panel, the IPCC, you know, actually doing what it's supposed to be doing? And how independent is it? Because I know you've looked into who's on it and how they were appointed.
First I can say that there's a huge difference in the estimate from Peter Wadhams and to the climate panel, where the climate panel is more like saying that your young kids or maybe their future children may be around to see the first day with no ice, not you or I, and definitely not this year or next year. So these extremely conservative estimates for the ice and for global warming made Professor Wadhams call the climate panel criminally complacent in a recent interview.
Does this mean that computer models haven't really developed since the 1990s? I mean, surely, you know, there must be some kind of peer review going on here where various scientists are critiquing it, publishing the critiques, and that there's some sort of agreement. It just seems to me that you've got a massive divergence of views with no proper settling down of scientific opinion.
Exactly. I think the reason is that the computer models, they only include the known mechanisms to science today, and only the stuff that we have numbers for and that are well known. The real ice loss trends, on the other hand, are based on the full destructive force working on the ice. That's written down in the data. So that gives you sort of the full system response. And as it happens, the criminally complacent IPCC timelines, they happen to suit the industrialists and the fossil fuel lobby very well. So that's kind of strange.
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe worth introducing at this point one of my analysis, which I've done over the last few years, helped by correspondents on the internet who've read my articles, commented on those articles, emailed me, etc. And this is really to do with the oil industry's power back in the 1950s and 1960s, when the North Sea oil was first discovered. Now, Torstein, the Norwegians have dealt very differently, haven't they, to the British in the way they've dealt with oil. How have you done things over in Norway?
I'm not an expert in that, but I think when Norwegians discovered oil and started their state-owned oil company, there was a greater share of the revenue going back to the Norwegian state, you know, to use for societal purposes.
Martin?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting to compare what happened in Britain and what happened in Norway, because they were discovering that it was the end of the 70s where these oil deposits were discovered. And in Norway, because you had a very fairly stable Labour Party regime that had been in power since the end of the war, they knew that they didn't have to rush. They didn't have any skills in oil exploration, but they just knew they'd have to train up. So they took longer to come on stream. Whereas in Britain, they had a Labour government, Tony Ben was the Minister of Energy, and they were under pressure to bring it on stream as quickly as possible so that the revenues from it could then be used to keep Labour in power. But of course, it didn't work out like that. They brought in the US majors to do it, to do it quickly, so that British oil production got going much faster than in Norway. But of course, it didn't actually get, all they did eventually is hand the whole prize to the Conservative government of Margaret Thatcher, who then used the North Sea oil money to deindustrialise the country. Whereas, of course, in Norway, you've actually got an increase in the number of people employed in manufacturing industry during this period because of the skillful way they've managed the oil legacy. So the sovereign wealth fund isn't allowed to invest in Norway itself, because that would actually push the krona up and destroy industry. So they haven't done that. And of course, if you look at the Piper Alpha disaster in the British part of the North Sea, the oil well exploded and the accommodation block was above the oil well, so that hundreds of people were killed. And in the Norwegian sector of the North Sea, the accommodation block isn't even on the same platform as the oil well. It's on a different platform completely. But in the cheapskate British North Sea, they put the accommodation block right on top of the oil well, which, of course, when it exploded, killed hundreds of guys.
Well,
more than were killed in the Iraq War, for example, in the British
one of these my contacts, and a terrific writer, actually, written for Counterpunch and people like that, is Alf Mendes. And he was an oil worker back in the 1950s and 60s, and explained to me just how so many of the bad practices by employers were introduced in the North Sea oil and in the oil industry generally. Things like putting people onto self-employed contracts rather than giving them proper holidays and jobs. Yeah, this is a long while back. And things like the 0 hours contracts, where you may be on a contract and not get a lot of these things, were introduced by the oil industry because the pay was so good, and also because they're actually very political. A lot of their management, senior management executives, really did want to make sure that they were part of breaking the trade unions and labour laws, which of course do a lot actually to look after our safety. But look, getting back to what I was saying about North Sea oil, it was really to do with the United States actually being the people who financed it. A lot of people were puzzled about that, but the oil industry apparently went to the city and said, well, will you please finance the rigs? Now we've discovered oil in the North Sea. And the City of London wouldn't. There are all sorts of reasons for that, because the city for a long time has not really wanted to fund engineering projects, lots of reasons. But anyway, the Americans then stepped in, but they said, well, we'll fund your North Sea oil rigs, but only if you get rid of your railways in Britain and you open up a domestic market for oil. Otherwise, it would depress the world oil price. Just seems to me, Martin, that what we're dealing with here is policy, international policy, which is largely predicated around energy, including these wars in the Middle East today we've got. And even back then, that was one of the main reasons why the Americans wanted to finance this, wanted to control the finance of it, is to keep the price of oil up, because their currency relies on the petrodollar.
It does. I mean, and of course, the Norwegians have very cannily, used their oil in a very different way. So the trade unions, for example, were banned in the North Sea in Britain, so that anybody who was seen to be a trade union activist was immediately sacked. So the Oil Industry Liaison Committee used to have to meet in secret, which was an attempt by Ronnie MacDonald and others to try and organise the North Sea before Piper Alpha. Whereas, of course, in Norway, the Statoil state oil company recognises trade unions, and trade union representatives can stop production at any stage if they think there's a safety issue. And if you look at the well managed oil industry in Norway and the cheap state sharks who run it in Britain, and of course we have actually wasted all of the revenue from North Sea oil on paying out unemployment benefits in the 1980s, whereas of course in Norway the money is going to be paying for nursery schools for 50-60 years into the future.
Just looking back again at the story to do with the yacht from Bristol, the guy, it's a great little story on the BBC Science and Environment website, Yacht Sails Through Low Ice Arctic Sea Routes, by Jonathan Amos, who's a BBC Science correspondent this week. He mentions the name of the adventurer. who is David Hempelman Adams, and he's aimed to sail the Arctic's North Sea and Northwest Passages in a single season. Well, his yacht is called Northabout. It's due back in Bristol soon. It left in June. But I was just quite staggered to see, Torstein, that he's actually sailed right the way round the Arctic Circle, really, above, starting off north of Norway, then sailing across, right across the top of Russia, across the top of the Bering Straits between Russia and Alaska, and then right across the top of Canada. And he's now heading back to, just in the North Sea back here to Bristol. But he is making the point, the most important point, of the fact that this would have been impossible just a few years ago.
Yeah, or of course, there's always a Norwegian who's done it before. So Børge Ausland, he did that like 5 or 10 years ago, I think, both of the passages.
Ah, right, so it's not impossible. It wasn't impossible just a few years ago. He's just copying what the Norwegians are doing. So maybe this is just a PR stunt.
Well, I don't know.
Anyway, so so they'll be back in Bristol soon. Interesting to hear that, and I think maybe we should say, are you copying this guy from Norway? He's just done it when he comes back here to Bristol. But Martin, there's no denying that the ice is receding. The only question is, how long? I mean, we've heard from Torstein and from Peter Waddams that it's any time now. But surely, I mean, just looking at the amount of ice there is, yes, it's shrinking, but it's not disappearing this year or next year or any time in the next few years, surely.
Well, I'm not an expert in these matters, so I hesitate to take a strong opinion, although it seems to be the case, as Torstein hinted earlier, that the attitude, if the Arctic is shrinking, it actually opens up the Arctic to further exploration for oil. And that, you know, there's an awful lot of argument about who actually owns chunks of the Arctic. And you may remember that the Russians put a flag on the North Pole, on the bottom of the ocean, underneath the North Pole, to make it clear that they felt that it all belonged to them. And, of course, the Canadians and others don't necessarily accept that. I don't think the Norwegians are going to accept it either. But there's a potential for conflict in the Arctic over resources, particularly oil, as the ice melts. And the big players aren't thinking, oh gosh, the ice is melting, we better stop. They're actually saying, well, this will give us an opportunity to get this even more oil and other minerals out of the Arctic.
The other point to make to challenge what you're saying, Torstein, is in this BBC article, he's saying that this week the Arctic sea ice reached the second lowest extent ever recorded by satellites. Well, that's only the second lowest ever, so it's not every year it's been shrinking, clearly.
No, there's a difference between the lowest ever for, you know, the one lowest day, which is generally in mid-September. So what I've looked at, and lots of other people have looked at, is what is the average over the summer or over the entire year. And then 2016 is the lowest since satellite records began in 1979. So it's the lowest in the trend so far, and it's everything. If you look at the trend and the graph for the trend based on the data for sea ice extent and volume, it's straight down, and it's I compare it to the curve. If you sail a ship from Portugal to Southampton and you had completed 80% of its journey, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out when you will be at port in Southampton. It's like quite obvious calculation to make. And in Peter Waddams' case, it's like from 0 to 1 years from now.
But that surely is, I mean, that's just an exaggeration, surely. I mean, it is certainly, it's shrinking bit by bit. But, I mean, you're not going to tell me that next summer there's going to be no ice at all in the Arctic.
For one day. That's what we're talking about. And what I've done myself is to study the sea ice data from the orbiting satellites.
So you can get access to that, can you, if you want?
Yeah, that's public information.
Right.
And I'm actually writing now a non-fiction book explaining exactly what is happening to the ice and where you can get the data yourself and look at it, so you don't have to trust these scientists or these politicians.
Well, the climate change panel, let's go back to look at them for a minute, because how were they set up and why is it that you don't trust them?
Well, in the they were set up like from 1986. It started pre-set up, and it they emerged in 1988. And by then, a number of scientists had started to speak up about a very real need for political action to stop greenhouse gas emissions. But the energy is a very lucrative business, as we all know. And so we had the so-called climate panel, and their 2 feet or so of sea level rise by the magical year 2100. And these corrupt forecasts, if you will, have been used to sideline the scientists calling for immediate action to stop the impending collapse of human civilization. So it's pretty huge crime we're talking about here, right?
So, yeah, but I mean, surely it's not going to mean... I mean, it might mean that we have to put our woolly jumpers on, but surely... Or actually, no, have to take our woolly jumpers off in the winter. But surely not human civilization is not under threat by this, is it?
Well, not only that, Tony. Even the biosphere itself is naturally threatened by a runaway, self-reinforcing heating of the planet. Our civilization, our way of living... It's just higher up on the list of things that are going to collapse in a rapidly warming world. If our key food production collapses, mainly due to sea level rise and sick weather, civilization has no grain and rice to store for winter and collapses upon us.
Martin, this is one of the sort of original things that human societies did, wasn't it? And you can almost start to chart the rise of civilization from the first time that grain was stored, this kind of thing. And it looks what Torstein's saying is we may have no grain to store at some point in the not-too-distant future.
Well, I think that's quite possibly the case. But I think we're also underestimating the danger of nuclear war, which will actually be more devastating than climate change if it happens. I don't know whether you mentioned earlier that some scientists are saying a nuclear war would be good because it would prevent climate change. But from my point of view...
Well, it would prevent global warming, yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's... I mean, we actually came very close to nuclear war in the 1980s. We were protesting against cruise missiles at the time in Britain, and we didn't know, but in actual fact, we came right close to the brink because the Russians were so paranoid about the stance that was being pushed by Reagan and Thatcher that they put their nuclear forces on a hair trigger, and they very nearly pressed the button in 1983. And we now know it was actually a decision made by a particular Russian commander not to press the button. But he came right close to pressing the button. He was so paranoid. And eventually, if there was a spy at the top of NATO who told the Russians that in actual fact they're blustering, they don't intend to attack you, they look as if they're going to attack you, but in actual fact they're bluffing. And at that point, the Russians calmed down a bit because they actually took Reagan and Thatcher at their word. They thought they were preparing a first strike. And as we speak now, NATO is deploying missiles in Romania and in Poland in order to basically carry out a first strike on the Russian leadership.
Well, hang on, that's taking us back almost to the Cuban missile
crisis. Well,
the Americans, when the Russians started moving their nuclear missiles into Cuba, right on the doorstep of Florida and the United States, the continental US, that was enough of a reason for Kennedy, as it was at the time, the Americans and the Strategic Air Command, to actually threaten the Russians, get out or it's war.
That's right. Well, I mean, the Russians are not happy. I mean, we have had a debate in, you know, a half-assed debate in Britain about whether we're going to keep Trident or not, but nobody mentioned in any of that, well, hang on a minute, we're taking a hostile posture here. We are placing missiles in Romania and Poland, which are designed to decapitate the Russian leadership so that they will not be in a position to fire back.
Well, you seem to be saying we shouldn't be bothered about climate change, because this is much more
pressing. Saying we shouldn't be bothered about climate change. I'm just saying, let's not forget nuclear war as a number one threat to our existence as a species.
And Torstein, what about this idea that nuclear winter might be actually quite good for cooling things down and stopping global warming?
Well, then there are plenty of these ideas around, you know, and Wadhams is one of the people who are talking about tactical ways to delay climate change or global warming.
Climate war.
Yeah. and of course, obviously, some kind of nuclear winter would set back the collapse of the sea ice by 2 years or 3 years. But it's no, you know, you would kill off a lot of animals and river systems and fish. And, you know, it's not the ideal solution in any case.
So is Wadhams one of the people who's advocating a nuclear war so that we can slow down global warming?
Absolutely not, but he has one of these geoengineering suggestions. It's basically just to pump white bubbles of sea water into the lower clouds and then making a cloud brightening effect, which will reflect more of the solar more of the sun rays back into the into space and save the ice from melting.
I mean,
melting.
These sorts of geoengineering, I'm always a little bit nervous about them. Isn't it the best thing to do just to stop burning fossil fuels?
Yeah, of course, Peter Wadhams and a lot of other so-called climate scientific activists suggested maybe cutting back on the emissions already in the 80s, right? So it's not like it hasn't been suggested, but the fossil fuel lobby and the energy industry, they set up this nice United Nations climate panel, didn't they? And they think we have a very long time to fix this problem.
So how long do you think until civilization is actually threatened? I realise, you know, you actually think that, in a way, to a certain extent, the activism is over because the climate change, the fossil fuel lobby has won the battle.
Yeah, basically. So when I'm writing this non-fiction book, it's more or less to warn other good people and make them able to prepare for what is coming and or to enjoy their lives, you know, whatever number of decades they have remaining.
I mean, we're hearing from the Germans, this is on the nuclear war side, Martin, potentially, or war anyhow, from the Germans and the Swiss, that they're actually saying to their citizens, you should make sure you've got at least 10 days supply of food and water in your homes.
Well, that's because they're also potentially going to be some kind of false flag terrorist attack in Germany. That's possible. And, of course, there also is a potential for war with Russia, because that's what Hillary Clinton is banging the drum for as we speak. And, you know, she's making it pretty clear that that's what she wants. And the Russians, of course, are behaving relatively calmly. And it's a good job that they are being calm. If they had a more hysterical leadership, we'd already be over the brink. But it's far more dangerous than people realise.
Torstein, it does seem as if a lot of this debate is being controlled, whether it's through the funding for the scientists or whether it's through the London media. We in this country, the international media. What do you see as some basic things that we should be doing to sort this out? I mean, if you were appointed to head the UN, I mean, I don't actually think that the head of the UN can make a difference. It's the head of the big oil companies that seem, and the banks that seem to be really in the driving seat. But what changes would you like to see?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I think I would pick Peter Wadhams to head the IPCC, the climate panel. And then I would urge every nation on Earth to translate A Farewell to Ice and make it compulsory reading in public schools so that people could be warned about, you know, how to deal with all of this crisis coming.
What in a nutshell, what's he saying in Farewell to Ice then? He's saying that we're really in... I mean, he sounds to me as if he's one of the most alarmist of all of these climate scientists. I mean, if he's saying that there's no ice virtually now, I mean, he's just simply not right, is he?
Well, the thing is, he's found out that he's looked at the thickness of the Arctic ice, and he found out that from the 70s to the 1990s, there was a 60% drop in the total volume of ice.
Okay, so it's one thing to look at it from space, but you need to actually measure how much ice you can see underneath you. You're only getting a two-dimensional picture from space.
The thing is, he sailed under the Arctic sea ice in submarines. That's part of his 40-year experience in the polar oceans. And the shocking thing is that from the 1970s to 2010s, there was an 80% drop in Arctic sea ice. So Wadhams actually tried to warn people at Whitehall in the early 90s, but it was just rudely dismissed by people there claiming that no, there's no problem with the Arctic ice. It will last to the end of the 21st century, which is, you know, just ridiculous rubbish.
Martin, it's a real controversial subject, climate change generally. Can you give us your just general assessment as to what the major influences are that are telling us what to think about this, because it just seems like we're not getting the facts properly through.
Well, I was pleased to see that both Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth have knocked out of play the idea of cap and trade, which is the idea that there would be a general agreement about the amount of carbon emissions countries could make, and then countries could sell these on a market. So they were trying to create a sort of market in carbon credits, which, of course, the hedge fund people were just slavering at the mouth at the possibility of doing that. I think if we are going to control the amount of resources that we use, including fossil fuels, we're going to have a plan. A bit like Britain had a plan in World War II for how much oil and coal it needed to fight the war. And at that stage, of course, they're trying to get as maximum as they could. But if you want to reduce the amount of resources we use, and I think this is independent of the science of climate change, because some people do question the science of climate change, but I think it's irrefutable that the wealthy section of the world's population uses resources completely without thought of the future. And that's got to stop. We have got to reduce the use of all resources, fossil fuels, uranium, fresh water, everything has got to be, we've got to share fairly, we've got to provide for everybody, and we've got to reduce the amount that we use.
Hang on a minute, Martin. People have got a rapacious appetite for, number one, getting to and from work, and number two, using electricity at home.
Yeah, well, in that case, we've got to redesign our way of life to be less destructive of the planet, and that's going to involve redistribution of wealth from the relatively prosperous to the poor. That's got to be part of it.
Is there any prospect of that, do you think, Torstein?
No, I think I totally agree with Martin that we should have a fair and just planet and treat southern people better and, you know, basically be nice to each other. But I don't think there's time enough for any of that before we basically hit the brick wall.
You're sounding a bit pessimistic about all this.
Not really pessimistic, but it's more like I've been a climate or environmental activist for 30 or 35 years, and what I found is that, yeah, we should have tried something like that, like in the 80s, and so it's kind of, to me personally, I think it's a relief to just realize, okay, and try to accept what is coming.
And write a book about it. Okay.
Of course.
Can I just make a comment, Tony, which is, I think there's going to be a financial crash, and that financial crash will then lead to a major economic depression that will make the 1930s look like a Sunday afternoon tea party. Now, one of the effects of such a crash will be to massively reduce the use of fossil fuels, coal, etc. Now, in other words, then you will then have an opportunity to rebuild after the crash without increasing the amount of fossil
fuels.
That's
handy, isn't it? Because if you get your war as well, there won't be any oil coming in.
Well, if we get a nuclear war, we won't be able to discuss any of it anyway. There'll be nobody left to argue, will there?
Well, I don't think, even after a nuclear war, there might be some people left. What about, Torstein, what about you've talked about the collapse of civilization. Could this lead to the extinction of life, do you think, completely? And what's the prospect of that if things do go completely wrong with the climate and it starts heating up? Obviously, after it gets to a certain extent, it might just start heating and heating and heating, and there's nothing we can do about it and go past any kind of hope of equilibrium.
Well, I think life on Earth in general, if you're talking about every kind of life on Earth, is pretty sturdy, and it has survived at least 3 billion years so far. So, it comes down to what kind of life are we talking about? Are we talking about single cell organisms or cockroaches, or are we talking about sentient, intelligent life with a vertebrate backbone or something?
Well, who knows? You might end up with sentient cockroaches. Who knows?
Yes, once we've been
over to you, Martin.
Once we've been cleared out of the way, they've got a free run, haven't they?
Okay, just finally, I mean, we will be covering this when this ship gets back in October, back to Bristol. Torsten, I'll just give the final word to you. If one of the things we like to be able to do is just think of one thing we can do to change the way we do things, which is actually going to make a difference. Is it past that? Are the structures of society, the use of fossil fuels, so embedded that it's very difficult for any individual to really make a small difference themselves?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much too late for any new good ideas to solve it.
What's your book? Okay, sorry. Okay, but what's your book called, and when's it out?
It's going to be out in October, and it's going to be something about ice, but I can't say yet.
Okay, Torstein Vidal from Oslo, Norway. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thanks to you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, Martin, how Israel stole the bomb. When Israel launched a covert scheme to steal material and secrets to build a nuclear bomb, US officials looked the other way and obstructed investigations described in a book reviewed by James D. Eugenito. This is on Consortium News. In CIA in 1968, Richard Helms was presented with a disturbing national intelligence estimate stating Israel had obtained atomic weapons, a dangerous development that occurred earlier than the CIA had anticipated. It was regularly particularly dangerous because just a year before, the Six-Day War had marked the beginning of an open hostilities between Israelis and Arab nation states. Ah, so this is just the year after the Six-Day War, not the year before, as I said earlier on. Martin, this is slowly but surely unfolding. This was under the reign of Lyndon Johnson, by the way. Helms arranged a meeting with the President, Lyndon Johnson, to inform him of his troubling milestone had been passed. But we keep hearing, don't we, over the years, information trickling out about the Israeli atomic bomb. They still deny, they still refuse to confirm or deny they've even got them.
To confirm or deny, the reason being that in US law, a country which is not signed up to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty like Israel, if they have nuclear weapons, then there is automatic sanctions on that country. And in fact, of course, every individual Israeli is in receipt of thousands of dollars of subsidy from the US taxpayer every year to keep them in the style to which they've become accustomed. And if they were to follow the letter of US law, if they admitted they had nuclear weapons, then all that funding would have to end. That's why the Israelis like to let the world know that they've got them, because they like to chuck their weight about and threaten people and so on. Like, the, you know, we could turn Iran into a sea of glass. But they don't actually want to finally come out and say, yes, we've got them, because then that would open them up to being saying, well, hang on a minute, you're not supposed to have them. And, of course, they stole them from the Americans with help of insiders. Jonathan Pollard, who was put in prison in the US as a spy, he, for money, gave the Israelis all of the US's nuclear secrets.
Well, it wasn't just these nuclear secrets, it seems, that they were given. It's actually enriched uranium itself that the Israelis could then use to make a bomb.
Indeed, yes. I mean, there's been lots of espionage by the Israelis inside the US to get all the
tests that were done. The nuclear signature actually traced back to the highly enriched uranium came from Portsmouth, Ohio, and then was further processed at a plant in Apollo, Pennsylvania. So it was US enriched uranium that found its way into the Israeli bombs.
Indeed. And but Pollard was later on, he basically sold the Israelis all the details of the US nuclear arsenal, which the Israelis then sold on to the Soviet Union on the understanding that the Soviet Union would be understanding about allowing Jews to emigrate to Israel. So there was a steady flow of Israeli of Jews from the former Soviet Union to Israel, allowed out by the Soviets, because the Israelis had given them the US's nuclear codes and so on. And of course, Pollard was caught and put in prison, and he's just been released recently by Obama, because of the Israelis have been lobbying for him to be released for years and years and years, because he's one of their spies.
Well, one of the officers at Apollo, this base, this place in where the nuclear material came from, this enriched uranium came from in the US, served as a national president of the Zionist Organization of America, in which Katchin, another officer, also held a leadership role. The ZOA, Zionist Organization of America, was a group of the American Zionist Council, which later became the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC. So obviously these people were very closely connected through the Israeli lobby in the US.
Yeah. And it's if you read James Petras's stuff on globalresearch.ca, he's a professor of political economy, a retired professor of political economy at New York University, and he's saying, well, the Israeli lobby in the US is enormously influential. It's the most influential lobby of all. And, of course, there's evidence linking Mossad to various terrorist incidents, including 9/11.
So, I mean, what, it's okay, basically what, just a
state. I mean, Israelis are
just
rogue
a minute.
State.
What evidence is there linking the Israelis to 9/11 then?
Well, there's a number of things. But the most obvious thing that people can look up if they go online is the five dancing Israelis who were seen clapping and cheering when the first plane hit the World Trade Center. Somebody noticed them doing that and sent the registration number of the van that they were all standing on top of to the local police. They were arrested 8 hours later. Turns out they were all Mossad agents filming the event, even though it was a supposed surprise attack. They were interrogated and eventually released. They went on television in Israel saying, yes, we were Mossad agents, but it was all harmless. We were just documenting the event.
Now, David John earlier on
had foreknowledge.
David John earlier on mentioned the leaked emails of Colin Powell. Well, one of these leaked emails we're just hearing today, literally just a few hours ago, it says Israel has 200 nukes all pointed at Iran, says the former US Secretary of State. Details in the latest revelation to emerge from a cache of leaked communications which has set Washington on edge. Now, this is a little bit like the Hillary emails, Martin, which is a good way to talk about Hillary Clinton and her illness. It seems that she's got pneumonia, although there are questions about whether maybe Putin has poisoned Hillary Clinton.
Well, there's an awful lot of silly talk going on about that sort of thing. It's true. But just coming back to the Israeli story, Martin von Creveld, who's a famous historian in Israel and a sort of defence intellectual, he basically said European states had better beware because we have the capacity to nuke Rome, Berlin, and Paris if we want if they try and cross us, and he openly said that.
Colin Powell was writing to business partner and Democratic donor Jeffrey Leeds regarding Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech to US Congress, warning them against a nuclear deal with Iran, which would limit Tehran's nuclear ability in return for lifting sanctions. So it does seem that if you're a donator to one of the political parties in the US, that all the secrets go out of the book and they will just tell you anything on email. And this is also, of course, Hillary Clinton's emails were leaked too, weren't they?
Yeah, but I mean, if she's claiming that that they were hacked by the Russians, because she's trying to distract attention from what's in the emails, which is that she stole the Democratic nomination from Bernie Sanders, which is why Debbie Wasserman Schultz had to resign as head of the Democratic National Committee. You know, lots of people were disenfranchised. They didn't play by the rules. You know, it makes the coup in the Labour Party look positively benign.
Okay, look, I'm going to drag you back to talking about Hillary, though. She had the first one I've seen of these coughing fits back in February. She's been chatting, kissing her kids, all this sort of thing. If she had pneumonia, surely she wouldn't be doing that. Are there any other theories about what is wrong with Hillary?
Well, there are various theories circulating. One is that she's got Parkinson's disease, which was related to cocaine use, possibly by her and Bill back in the day. There's all sorts of rumours swirling around. But I think the politics of this are getting quite sharp, because if it gets to the point where either because of her misdemeanours or because of her health, she cannot run, then the question becomes, well, who is the Democratic Party's candidate? And I think the rule book is fairly clear. It should be Bernie Sanders. But there's already things going on in the background where the establishment in the Democratic Party are doing their best to think of a way that they can, you know, if they have to ditch Hillary, where they can get somebody like Biden or the vice president, whose name now escapes me, to be the candidate rather than Sanders. But in actual fact, a Sanders versus Trump election would be a fair test of the voters' views. A Clinton-Trump election means many people on the left really haven't got anybody to vote for, because Hillary Clinton is pretty right-wing and very, very belligerent in foreign policy terms, far more so than Trump.
So what do you make of going back to this? I know you're not a doctor. I'm not expecting you to know whether it's pneumonia or not, but it does look as if these coughing fits have been going on for a long, long time now.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're going to elect somebody to be the president, you've got to hope that they've got a 4-year term. They've got to be able to get through that 4-year term. Otherwise, you're basically electing the vice president. She's chosen a very right wing pick for a vice president. She didn't make any concessions at all to the Sanders wing of her own party, and in many ways, I think it's actual fact she stole the nomination. That's what many lawsuits and that, you know, lots of people are suing the Democratic Party. And of course, the leaks from the Democratic National Committee, not her personal leaks when she was at the State Department, they are all basically probably been leaked by Sanders supporters who are disgusted by the fact that Clinton has stolen the nomination, because she has. She didn't have the numbers. She had all the superdelegates sewn up well in advance, but she also, you know, lots of people turned up to vote for Bernie Sanders in various parts of the US to be told that they weren't on the list to vote, et cetera, et cetera. So she's rigged, the whole thing's been rigged for her to be the candidate.
Now,
and
that's
not necessarily acceptable.
Now, I've got an apology to make, actually, because we made quite an important error last week. We had a discussion about Syria. I'm not blaming you for this, Martin. I introduced Brooks Newmark, who we heard talking at the Friends of Syria at the day of the Friends of Syria conference, as a MP, and we also heard that he was chair of the All Party Group on Syria, and I got my information from Peter Allen on BBC Five Live. Let's just have a little listen to that now, because it turns out that actually Brooks Newmark hasn't been an MP for about 18 months. He was actually kicked out at the last general election because of a whole scandal to do with sexting, texting naked pictures of himself to women, asking them to have sex with him, begging them to have sex with him, even though he's married. And so the Conservatives decided to drop him at the last election. Nevertheless, this is what Peter Allen said last week on Five Live, who himself, it seems, has now been dropped from Five Live's, I think it's called Five Live Daily that he does during the week. So let's just have a listen to what Peter Allen said now.
I'm going to begin, though, with the comments of a Conservative MP called Brooks Newmark, who chairs the all-party parliamentary group of Friends of Syria. I spoke to him just before we came on air, because he's one of those involved in the conference right now, and I began by asking him about those chlorine bomb attacks on Aleppo.
Ever since we had that famous red line back in 2013 with respect to the use of chemical weapons, Assad changed his strategy from using what was defined as a chemical weapon to using what are effectively chlorine bombs. And chlorine, unfortunately, under the definition of a chemical weapon, doesn't fit within that.
And Brooks Newmark then goes on to discuss these things, but of course he's not actually an MP, Martin, at all. And he's not certainly not chair of the All Party Group on Syria, not being an MP anyway.
Well, indeed, and therefore the BBC are remiss to use him as a spokesperson. I mean, he's obviously got an opinion on Syria, but he's not an MP and he's not a chair of the committee.
They don't seem to do their checking when someone comes on the radio or they want to put somebody on the radio. I would not blame Peter Allen for that. I think it's his producer's fault. Mm. His producer is not named, actually. It's very difficult to find out who his producer is. But they would have written that and prepared that piece for him. And it seems to me that it's them that should go, not him.
Well, indeed. But I think the BBC have actually allowed themselves to be used shamelessly for promoting war with Syria.
The Ghouta attack, for example, and also, of course, the famous one we were talking about earlier, which is the weapons of mass destruction that never existed to justify an attack.
Well, indeed,
on Iraq.
I mean, you see, you've got pundits like the ex-Tory MP going on about the Ghouta chemical weapons attack, and there's been loads and loads of evidence suggesting that it wasn't carried out by Assad at all. It was carried out by NATO intelligence services working with the al-Nusra Front. And that's the evidence for that is overwhelming.
Anyway, big changes in Syria this week as we have Russian troops taking up positions in Aleppo. So we've got Chinese advisers, Russian troops, Russian aircraft. It doesn't seem like, it seems like basically like Assad has got backup.
Yeah, and I suppose that there's supposedly a ceasefire that's been agreed between the Russians and the Americans.
Am I right in thinking this is why the Russian troops have been brought in, because they don't necessarily trust the Turks to be making sure that all this is humanitarian aid and not weapons?
Well, the Russian military, their naval marines, they've taken over from the Syrian army on the particular route into Aleppo. And I think that's part of the deal that's been done between the Americans and the Russians. There's some doubt about whether this ceasefire is going to hold, because various elements on the rebel side don't want to accept it. And, the war should be over by now, but it isn't, because we're still feeding weapons in there to keep it going.
Also, US and Turkey's annexation of Syria is aimed at pressing Russia on regime change. So Turkey's basically moved in to take over parts of northern Syria.
Well, indeed, and they're going to use the bit of Syria they've taken over as a staging ground for the Free Syrian Army, who are going to carry on trying to overthrow Assad. Free Syrian Army, of course, being basically jihadis, like all the other terrorists that they've been fighting all along.
Look, moving over to the South China Sea and the Philippines, what about these amazing revelations this week of President Duterte, who ordered death squad hits while he was mayor, and also actually killed people with an Uzi machine gun himself, we're being told, by a whistleblower who identifies himself as Edgar Matabato. He testified he was part of a 300-member death squad run by the now president, which he alleges was run on the orders of Duterte. It just is absolutely horrendous that somebody like this should then be made president. He also accused Duterte of killing a member of the Department of Justice with an Uzi submachine gun whilst he was serving as the mayor of Davao. It was the mayor Duterte who killed him. He finished two Uzi magazines into him. He said at this inquiry, Martin, the Philippines just sounds like an absolute mafia stronghold.
Well, I mean, Duterte has obviously got a pretty bad pretty bad human rights
record. The president's son is implicated too.
Well, yes. He's relatively popular amongst the ruling classes in the Philippines because they want a strong man like Ferdinand Marcos, and he fulfills that role. And, of course, the Philippines have been pushed to litigate against China about the islands that they're fighting over because, of course, there's no basis for that. There isn't really a basis for arbitration.
OK, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Our sister show, Dialect, airs on BCFM at noon every Tuesday. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, David John, Deputy Lord Lieutenant. Our show page for comments is onewordthisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Censor Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips, in studio with journalist and co-founder of the Occupy Wall Street Journal and the editor now of Occupy.com, Michael Leventon. He's our co-host today. Mickey Huff will return next week. In today's show, we examine the Occupy movement 5 years later with clips from the new movie American Autumn and two guests, Peter Rue and Noah Fisher, both from New York and members of the Occupy movement at the time. We'll also look at the documentary film Heist. This film reveals the reasons behind the Occupy movement regarding the roots of the American economic crisis, the continuing assault on working and middle-class people in the U.S. Hey, welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips in studio with Michael Leventon. He is the co-founder of the Occupy Wall Street Journal and now the current editor of Occupy.com, which is the ongoing communications about the Occupy movement. Mickey Huff will be back next week. But in today's show, we're going to examine the Occupy movement 5 years later with clips from the new movie American Autumn. Additionally, we'll look at the feature documentary Heist. This film reveals the reasons behind the Occupy movement regarding the roots of the American economic crisis. Heights talks about the crumbling structure of the U.S. economy as a result of four decades of deregulation, massive job outsourcing, tax policies that all favored mega corporations and wealthy elites. So we hope you stay with us today. Michael, tell us a little bit about your background with Occupy. And talk about our guest that we're going to have on from New York that was a member at that time.
Yeah, hi, Peter. I'm a Northern Californian myself, but I was in New York during the movement. Got there right as it was beginning. You know, I kind of saw it from the start, and curiously enough, I'm still, in some sense, part of it as editing Occupy.com. Really, as most people know, the movement, as it was, is no longer. It's not in the streets. It's not in the parks. It hasn't been for, you know, some 4.5 years. That's evident. What Occupy.com has tried to do, and what a lot of journalists throughout the country have continued to do, is to highlight the issues that Occupy raised as a movement when it sprung on the scene September 17th, 2011. Tomorrow is the 5-year anniversary. Those issues, I think, so many people are aware of, and whether they connect the dots and see that they really emerged in the public consciousness and in activism and in protests, emerged out of Occupy, you know, that's not necessarily a mainstream discussion. But issues like student debt, the huge protests over student debt and the movements around it, the climate movement itself that got a massive shot in the arm with Occupy, starting with the Keystone XL protests that ended up victorious and, you know, and went on to anti-fracking protests and the student divestment from fossil fuels movement with tens of billions of dollars divested from oil and gas companies. All of that kind of initiated from there. And you've got the workers' movement and you've got Black Lives Matter. And now you have the Standing Rock Sioux tribe occupying and stopping a pipeline in the Dakotas. I mean, really, the effects are what we've tried to document along with other alternative media throughout the country, and we're still doing it.
And I've watched the Occupy movement up in Sonoma County continue to be organized, engaged in a variety of things. They're particularly working on the anti-GMO effort right now.
Nice news, the fact that Monsanto has just been bought by Bayer. That's amazing. That's an interesting, who knows how many people are connecting the dots there? I'm not sure, but Monsanto's brand has been so tarnished in these last years. I think Occupy kind of put a target crosshairs on Monsanto, along with the huge pharmaceuticals, that, you know, that's another impact. It's like, this is a company that no longer can operate the status quo business as usual, and hence they're being bought. To rebrand as one reason.
The Special Project Censored Show on Occupy is a fund drive show, and we'd like to remind listeners that by calling 1-800-439-5732, you can pick up one of the premiums of the American Autumn, which is the Occupy Movement documentary, for $60, or the DVD Heist, Who Stole the American Dream, for $100, or both for $150. So that's a reminder, and we'll let you know more about that as we go along. We have a guest on the line. And, we don't have a guest on the line, so we're back to you, Michael. We want to play a clip from the movie American Autumn, and then we'll discuss that and try to get our New York guest on.
A reform movement, something that results in some kind of constitutional amendment, or is this a revolutionary movement?
I don't care. You can call it whatever you want. You know, words are our tools, unless we make them our masters. Most people have a practical streak, and they want to be able to believe that this kind of activity actually delivers results. And so that's, you know, the burden on a movement is to show that.
We had our chance for reform, and that was Barack Obama. And that was the last chance for reform. Now, Occupy Wall Street, this is a revolution. Whether we know it or not, this is a revolution. Because we are tired of the people, the 1% of the 1%, and what they have done to the country, what they've done to the world. Government is finished. It's not going to work. I don't care who we vote for, who we put into office. They're bought and paid for before they get there. This is absolutely a revolution.
Really, for us, I think that we're breaking through the apathy. We're breaking through the cynicism. We're breaking through the sense that, you know what, we can trust the state or beg the state to make solutions for us. And if they don't make solutions, we're just going to keep gritting on. When we have massive unemployment in the streets of the Bronx and Brooklyn, and when we have more homes that are empty and owned by banks than we have homeless people, and we could actually house the millions of homeless people we have in this country, people, you know, there is a sense that, you know what, if we had a little creativity and a little bit of drive, we could do it. Now we're at that point. We are not hopeless anymore. We're ready to fight.
The moment where there's a general awakening in society about certain realities of numerous situations we'll find ourselves in, specifically that we're creating a superclass. Yeah. And I don't mean hierarchical superclass, but just in terms of magnitude of people involved, of common understanding of what's going on, and we're engaging the powers that be in coming up with a solution out of the crisis we find ourselves in. And the crisis is not just, confined to an economical crisis, but it's also a crisis of morals and it's a crisis of values. The big part of it is storytelling. Ability to tell the story and propagate it to the greater world in various ways pretty much determines whether certain ideas survive or get buried under the onslaught of propaganda.
My name is Dennis. I made this movie, and there are a few things you should know about me right from the jump. I'm not an expert on the economy, climate change, or foreign policy. I'm also not an expert on sustainable farming systems, the history of social movements, or Legos. The Occupy movement has experts on all of those things and more, but I'm not really one of them. I'm a happily married husband, a father of two fantastic children. I live on a main street in a small New England town with actual white picket fences. I made this movie for you, me, and everyone we know in the hope that we can create a world where human need comes before corporate greed. So why does it feel almost un-American to say that? Think about it this way. Just go with me for a second here. You know that scene from the Oliver Stone film Wall Street when Gordon Gekko, played by Michael Douglas in a role that would win him an Oscar, appears at a shareholders meeting of a company, Teldar Paper, to defend his actions and his grotesque worldview, and delivers the now famous speech where he says,
"Greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. And greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA."
Audiences flipped out. They cheered. Everybody in the 80s wanted to be Gordon Gekko. But the thing is this, Oliver Stone wrote it as a piece of satire, but nobody got it. Just the opposite. While Oliver Stone was trying to send up the excesses of the Reagan era, Michael Douglas's portrayal helped inspire a whole generation of slick back hairdos in double-breasted suits, adopting the greed is good ethos, and pursuing the American dream, as it had come to be defined, now delivers obscene wealth for a very few, while raining poverty and misery down on many, and serving as a homicidal force for others. Because people do, in fact, die for lack of access to health care in the richest country in the world. That's the US of A. Human consumption is, in fact, accelerating the destruction of our planet. People do, in fact, die in wars waged based on lies that profit a precious few. Over 5 million children globally each year do not reach their fifth birthday because they die of starvation. All of this is not because the system that puts man on the moon or can squeeze an entire library onto a computer chip the size of a thumbnail has failed to find a way to solve these problems. Rather, our system, without apology, places corporate greed above human need. And greed, to take back the popular phrase, is not good. F*** you, Gordon Gekko. Now, the question many within the Occupy movement are trying to solve is this one. What would a world look like that had a culture and an economic system that places human need above corporate greed? And how do we bring that world into being? Who cares what it is called? Call it socialism. Call it real democracy now. Call it Chunky Monkey Cherry Garcia. The world needs to change radically, it needs to change dramatically, and it needs to change fast. This documentary is an invitation for you to participate in that positive change. Frankly, because we need you. Yes, you.
You're listening to that clip. That's from American Autumn, the new Occupy film, which is available for premium here by calling KPFA 1-800-439-5732. And I'm Peter Phillips, and in studio with me is Michael Levitin, co-editor of the Occupy.com. And our guest from New York is on the line. Michael, will you introduce our guest?
Yeah, Peter Ruegg, I believe, is over there across the continent in New York. Peter, you on?
Yep, that's me.
All right.
I'm right here.
Well, Peter and I met at Occupy Wall Street a whole 5 years ago, and we were part of actually a specific group called Disrupt Dirty Power. Peter was, as I was, much on the environmental side at Occupy, and part of the real goal of that group, that which was called the working group, was to raise awareness and really attack fossil fuel interests at their source, connecting the dots, showing where oil, gas, where that money is ending up in politicians' hands and how it's shaping legislation, climate change denial, building more pipelines, promoting fracking, etc. And building out of that, out of Occupy Wall Street, I think power, dirty power, has been disrupted in these last years. Peter, you want to tell people how kind of you see, you know, the going from Keystone XL pipeline, which was pretty much that protest was inaugurated in the early weeks of Occupy. How has the environmental movement been jump-started?
Well, the environmental movement and social movements across the country are widespread, widespread worldwide, and they are challenging the, you know, the 1%.
And Peter, in New York, you, Peter.
I think, you know, it's important to keep in mind, you know, right around when Occupy was kicking off, there was the largest civil disobedience in the history of this country, I believe, in D.C., led by 350.org and Bill McKibben. People were arrested by the hundreds day after day. I believe the total was something like 1,100, 1,200 people arrested, chaining themselves to the gates of the White House, protesting the Keystone XL. And what Occupy did was helped to accelerate a conversation in the mainstream environmental movement, something that local environmental justice groups have had known for decades, but had sort of been lost in the conversation in the wider movement, which is, you know, issues of climate change and fracking and these oil pipelines. These are really class issues. These are, we working people are being, having our futures robbed from us for the profit of giant multinational corporations. It's not just about bald eagles and polar bears. You know, there's that great saying in the Communist Manifesto where Marx says that capitalism has created its own grave diggers. Well, you know, if we look at the amount of CO2 that's being emitted into the atmosphere today, you could almost reverse it, that we're in danger of being put in our graves and our children's futures are at risk because of climate change, because of the 1%, because of dirty power. And Occupy really helped put that social justice conversation square in the center, threw down the gauntlet in the environmental movement.
Absolutely, Peter. And I mean, of course, the climate, the march, the People's Climate March that happened two summers ago in New York City, that was pretty unprecedented, right? Almost 500,000 people marching in downtown New York to demand climate action, which we more or less saw at the Paris Climate Summit the next autumn. But I mean, how do you see the Occupy movement really radicalizing? In a sense, it brought people out, young people especially, with the divestment movement. I mean, that was obvious. Tens of billions of dollars, ranging from Rockefeller Foundation to the biggest institutions, really, across the Atlantic and in Europe as well. I mean, this is a global movement, essentially started out of Middlebury College, where Bill McKibben launched 350.org with a handful of students some years ago. Mm-hmm. But Occupy, what did it? It did something that now has, you know, young people lying down on the tracks to stop coal shipments from going to the Western ports and oil trains and new projects like the Standing Sioux protests in North Dakota. I mean, that's an indigenous, specifically Native peoples standing for their rights, but this willingness of people to go out to defend the earth. Isn't that something different?
Yeah, it is. I think we realize that we can't be passive anymore. You know, when Occupy set up the encampment at Ducati Park, we were 3 years into Barack Obama's first administration, and a lot of people thought that we were going to get some change. And a lot of progressive groups didn't want to push too hard because they wanted to be allies with the administration. And what Occupy did was say, no, 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 no. You know, you have this Democratic president who is in favor of the Keystone XL, calls fracking, you know, clean burning fuel, is in favor of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And, you know, I think we on the left got to be a lot less trusting of politicians of the Democratic variety as well as the Republican variety. And I think no matter what, people learned that who's ever in office, we got to hit the streets and keep raising demands for social justice. And, you know, there was a great conversation between movements that happened at Occupy. I remember we organized a day of protest against Bank of America, and we worked together with housing activists here in New York City, people that said, we said, okay, you're foreclosing on people's homes, but you're also foreclosing on the planet, and we're going to get together, and we're going to challenge you. We're not going to let business as usual go on. We're going to keep disrupting it. And what's going on at the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation is something incredible that should make all we should all support it. It's people that are for 400 years have been oppressed, have been subject to a genocide, standing up on the front lines against oil companies. And we got to help push that movement as far as we can. And just as a side note, I think it's also very interesting. You know, in New York, we've had encampments here last month at City Hall, led by members of the Black Lives Matter movement. And so if you look at that together with the, and I believe there's an encampment in Chicago, there's been an encampment in Los Angeles. If you look at that, that tactic as well as of people refusing to leave until their demands are met, until the issues they care about are addressed, that's a tactic that Occupy helped reintroduce to the left in this country.
Yeah, Peter. Well, that's Peter. Thank you very much for being on the air with us. You are part of the continuing Occupy of the world. Standing Rock, you know, outstandingly is one of the centers of that right now. And it lays out the conflict between giant oil companies and the security forces they hire, G4S with the dogs attacking people, one of the largest security companies in the world. They're not going to be able to maintain that if thousands and thousands of people continue to do what Occupy did 5 years ago, and that's happening worldwide. So thank you very much for being on the air with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Peter. Okay, this was our Fun Drive show, and we are back to talk to you about the importance of keeping KPFA alive. And by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or donating online. And actually, if you donate online, that's great because it saves us the cost of the phone call and the paperwork to fill all that out. And I'm looking at 4 pledges right now from people online, 1 in New Zealand, and Monterey, Hayward, and Fresno, so we thank you very much. KPFA.org is the online number. And our pledges today are, you heard the first clip of this, the American Autumn, an Occupy Movement documentary, which is a $60 pledge. We also have the DVD Heist, Who Stole the American Dream, for a $100 pledge today, or you can pick up both, and they're very closely related. I mean, Heist talks about why the middle class was suffering so bad, high unemployment, how elites got so rich, and then, of course, the Occupy movement is a manifestation of that. So these two DVDs together are $150, and you can call right now, 1-800-439-5732, and make that support to KPFA. We're in our second week of Fun Drive here. Last week in the show, we did $3,500, and we want to hit that number again. We think it's really important to keep KPFA going. We're, you know, 2/3 of the way to our goal, and we have to have you continue to be involved and support us.
Yes, indeed, Peter. Yeah, that number again, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-KPFA, or www.kpfa.org. It's a pleasure, it's an honor to be able to talk about Occupy 5 years later to the day. September 17th, 2011 is when it all kicked off in New York City. We are one day before that right now. I think that everyone's seen this year, Peter, that with Bernie Sanders' rise as a contender for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States, that was something that was pretty unimaginable, and no one, even before this year, not to mention 5 years ago, no one ever could have seen that coming. You don't go up against the Democratic machine like Hillary Clinton with a message that Bernie Sanders had, which was essentially the Occupy platform type of message. It was
very much a message for the betterment of the humans and working people, to end war, to socialize, medicine, and bring about greater human betterment for the entire society, and that's what Occupy was about.
Yeah, I mean, he articulated the 99%. He and Elizabeth Warren, who are essentially now the stewards of the Democratic Party. I mean, Hillary might be running for the presidency, but the real energy of the Democrats, the new Democratic Party, is the progressive wing. And that is led by Elizabeth Warren, who won her election in 2012 on an Occupy 99% type platform, which is rein in the banks, jail the criminal bankers, end this corruption between Wall Street and Washington, you know, eliminate pharmaceuticals' power to lobby in Washington and all the rest for health care for, you know, the 99%. These people have articulated, and Bernie did it this year, and look at the success. And everyone under the age of 40, 90% of Americans under 40 years old, and a lot of others, went practically unanimously for Bernie. This shows that the future of the country, whether this election reveals it or not, between Hillary and Trump, the future and what people actually want and what they're able to see and discuss has been changed.
Providing financial support to KPFA supports this program and all the others here. Michael and I are both volunteers coming in here to volunteer at KPFA to produce the Project Censored Show. Mickey Huff will be back next week. And we're very proud to do that. We've been doing that for 6 years now, and we really think it's an important thing to do. And the two premiums that we decided to use today, the DVD American Autumn, an Occupy Movement documentary, and the movie, the DVD Heist, Who Stole the American Dream, both for $150. The Occupy DVD is $60, and the Heist DVD is $100. You can pick those up as a gift and support to KPFA for 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HKPFA, or do that online at www.kpfa.org. And we thank a pledge from Saratoga, Florida, that just came in. So I can see the online pledges coming in. I know that there's people phoning in as well. The 1-800-439-5732, we ask for your help. We ask for your support to keep this station alive, active, free, and not. We have no underwriters, you know, no big corporate gifts, no big foundation money. Almost all the money, you know, the way we keep this station going, it costs millions of dollars a year to keep the 59,000 watts, this building intact. All the activities and programs that we do, the news collection in particular, it's vital. And even though a lot of us are volunteers, there's still a paid staff here that has to keep this place going. And we ask you to support us and keep this alive. I mean, can you imagine what the world would be like if you didn't have KPFA? I mean, where would you get real news? I mean, certainly some online, but this is stuff you can listen to on your car radio as you're driving around or at home, and it's live. And we try to really keep up with what's happening in the world, and that's what the Project Censored Show is about. And we ask for your support right now. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HKPFA, or online at kpfa.org. That's how you can help. That's how you can support us. And that we really ask you to help make that donation today, right now at this hour, to show your love and support of the Project Censored Show. That keeps us alive and going well here. When you call in and say, yeah, I like what I'm hearing, this is important stuff, and you can understand a lot more about Occupy. I mean, when I go out and speak about Project Censored issues, people say, well, what happened to Occupy? And I'm happy to say, I say, well, it's just still there in many forms. The environmental movement, the anti-GMO movement, the, you know, people are engaged in anti police brutality. All of those are all outcomes and in the street outcomes of what Occupy was about, and the understanding, the mantra of the 99% versus the one, which is vitally important. It's certainly the one, not only the 1%, but the 1,000th of 1%, that top elite group of people in the world that control $100 trillion worth of wealth. We need to expose that and say, you can't keep having that. We want to tax you. We want, you know, full employment for the country. We want health care for everyone. We want free education for young people. That's vital. That keeps our society alive and going. And this is a way you can understand how we got to the situation we are today.
Yeah, Peter, that's, you raised the important points. I mean, the fact that many movements have spun off of Occupy, it's obvious to everyone that Occupy itself is no longer in the street. And really, whoever thought that people fighting for economic and social justice would spend the rest of their lives living in tents in parks to protest? it went to many places. And I think when you mentioned just now police brutality, for example, stage one of the police brutality movement as it currently is, I mean, that was highlighted at Occupy. Of course, it was highlighted in part because a bunch of white and largely economically middle class kids who were out protesting ended up getting beaten up and thrown in jail. It showed the country that the police control and defense of the banks and unwillingness to see people exercise their constitutional right to protest by throwing them in jails. Over 7,000 arrests during Occupy. That really woke people up and opened their eyes. But of course, the bigger issue is not police brutality against white middle class, college educated, mostly kids. It is against people of color. And I think what we've seen in the last 2 or 3 years with Black Lives Matter is a complete a new chapter in protest. It's a new culture of protest. Occupy enabled people to go to the streets and somehow lose their fear about what it means to stand up for your rights, whether it is anti-corporate, whether it's reining in the banks, jailing fraudulent, you know, money managers, or whether it's police who are unjustifiably jailing people and beating them and shooting them and killing them. I think that Black Lives Matter, it's a whole other ballgame. And they actually learned, people who organized that movement and who are still doing it, I think really learned and grew from Occupy, because it somehow it was more coherent, and it's had real elements of leadership and spokespeople and a message that has stayed on focus. It's still evolving, and there are issues and problems in that movement as well. But I think Black Lives Matter is a brilliant kind of evolution of Occupy. And that's just one, along with Citizens United and Getting Money Out of Politics movement, along with Fight for 15 and the labor movement and minimum wage. All of that grew out of Occupy
and
as well.
And Move to Amend.
Move to Amend and all the groups.
End of corporate personhood. So these are very, very important things. And you can say no to fear, and you can speak truth to power by supporting KPFA and keeping us alive on the air. 1-800-439-5732 is a number to call. 1-800-HEY-KPFA or online at kpfa.org. You can pick up either of these two premiums, both DVDs, American Autumn on the Occupy Movement, and the movie, The DVD Heist, Who Stole the American Dream? So we're going to go to a clip now from the DVD American Autumn, and you'll hear a little bit more of this important history of the Occupy movement.
The Occupy movement has become a conduit to a venue for talking about this corruption. And so folks like Move to Amend that are really, in my mind, setting the bar for the critique that corporations are not persons, money is property, not speech, and constitutional rights are for people only.
In 1856 in Dred Scott, this same Supreme Court said that people are property. Dred Scott affirmed slavery. In 2010, the Supreme Court said property is people. Both decisions are insane.
Multi-ethnic coalition of groups, individuals, organizations coming together with a singular purpose to demand to win a constitutional amendment to make it clear corporations are not persons. They do not have inherent inalienable rights. And money is not political speech. I want to be clear, the Move to Amend coalition is committed to both doctrines must be abolished. We cannot overturn corporate personhood and still allow wealthy individuals to spend unlimited amounts of money in our elections. Are we right? Are you with us?
The high trying to find something higher than what we're all mired in. Democracy? Monstrosity. Look around. It's a power monopoly. Have you noticed? People are like the stubble our society shapes. We get treated like refuse with the excuse that someone's got to lose for some corporation to win, as if it's not one world we all live in, you know, built on the backs of our poorest brothers. We've all forgotten the things we're all taught by our mothers. Share. Care for the people out there, be they dark or pale, cool or square, bald or hairy, as the monkeys we all evolved from. Add to the calls of greed, arrogance, pride, fight, that it'd be so much better if we just remembered that corporations are our creation. It is we, the people who comprise this nation. Corporations are our creation. It is we, the people who comprise this nation. Corporations are our creation. It is we, the people who comprise this nation.
Okay, that's the DVD, The American Autumn, which is available for $60 pledge here on KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. And Michael, another one of your friends from New York in the Occupy movement is on the line with us now. Will you introduce him?
All right. I believe Noah Fisher is on the other end. Noah is a Bay Area original. He is a San Francisco native. He has lived in New York for many years, and he's an artist and many things, sculptor and an organizer and really in political art. I met Noah at Occupy Wall Street. He has taken his work to Poland and has organized in Europe, making a kind of a transatlantic sort of cultural, artistic activism and doing many things. And he was involved in Occupy Museums intensely at Occupy Wall Street, trying to bring awareness of the connection of big money and sort of where big money has brought our artistic world and the cultural creations and limiting sort of the ability of standard of the 99% in the art world to get their voice out. Noah, after a long-winded introduction, you there?
Yeah. Hi, Michael. How are you doing?
All right. So, Noah, tell me, I mean, that message right there, we are unstoppable, another world is possible, listening to that, brought back those memories. We sure chanted that a fair amount. Where do you see, Noah, I mean, you really on the cultural and artistic side and really the street theater side, the side that's trying to awaken people and that was kind of jolting them awake in those early weeks of Occupy, riding trains and sort of raising that consciousness. Gosh, 5 years later, what's your thoughts?
Well, yeah, it's been an interesting 5 years, hasn't it, since 2011? And what I see is that the world has shifted, and that the movement has had a tremendous effect, you know, everywhere I look. And that specifically, I think the movement was very effective on a cultural level because we basically broke some taboos that existed before that about, you know, speaking directly about capitalism, about speaking about inequality in a way that was challenging the current system and expressing some of the pain and deep frustration that people still feel today around that. And it was kind of like impossible to say a few words in 2010, which was even after the crazy crash and everyone was in sort of had experienced the 2008 pain. And then after 2011, it became possible to talk about the 99% and the 1%. And now I see it, you know, everywhere I look. And Bernie's campaign, of course, being one of the most obvious examples of a whole giant national conversation that has changed, I think, because of the Occupy movement to a large degree.
And the fact that you were on really that cultural and artistic side of it, which is kind of hard and maybe abstract for some people, you know, to see. It's not the bread and butter sort of economic issues as much, but for people who are trying to survive, say, living on the fringe, how do you survive in San Francisco, in the Bay Area anymore as an artist, as a a culture creator, not to mention New York. How do you think, I mean, the culture of protest Occupy fundamentally shifted and changed, didn't it? Did it give, do you think, a new voice? I mean, it kind of, it's almost like it opened a whole new venue.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, you were there and I was there in New York. And I think that anyone who was in one of the squares shares the, you know, this feeling of just disbelief in watching it unfold. I mean, it was hard to imagine it was happening. And even now, even though there's a lot of protests and the Black Lives Matter protest has been so successful and so big, just imagining that there was a group of people who occupied kind of a random corporate square in New York. And then a few weeks later, their occupations are popping up in literally hundreds of cities across the country and then all over the world. And there's no center, you know, calling the shots of how it's going to go. People are just somehow on the same page, talking about inequality, talking about a system that's not working. I mean, that's a little hard to wrap your head around, but it actually happened. You know, so definitely a different kind of protest. I think it, you know, it's in relationship to our current moment of technology, because it was definitely happening online, and a lot of the organizing was happening online, and then people were getting right offline and meeting in the streets. And what, before, you were alluding to the street theater that I was involved in, and I saw, I mean, New York is a place where, you know, people are always bumping into each other, and the public space remains pretty charged, which is not true of every American city. And I saw that it was really important to bring it offline and just kind of, you know, just talk about it. And I, at one point, I really wanted to bring it into the subway system, because it's probably the most socioeconomically diverse space, you know, in the country, and the New York subway system. I thought, let's just turn the subway into a big conversation about what do we do about the, you know, the 1% taking all the assets and wealth of the country away. So that's happened a little bit, but I think there was a huge promise, and it was a different kind of protest that was happening.
Noah, hi, this is Peter Phillips. I recognize the importance of the Occupy movement and the spontaneity to which it emerged across the country and across the world. This seriously upset the elites in the world, the 1%.
Yeah.
And they, in turn, were asking their police state services, federal, state, and local, to repress this in every way possible, to infiltrate it, to put in agents provocateur, to do things that would upset the general public, like breaking windows and that. And their partners in corporate media, of course, the 1% of the owners of corporate media, and their messages are top-down, is there's no leadership, there's no message. And then as it slowly died down, oh, it just went away. It was spontaneous. So that's why I think we're doing this show today, and say, hey, yeah, it was significantly important, and it is ongoing and continuing, and it's gotten into the consciousness of almost everyone in the country. So could you expand a little bit on that idea?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I mean, so you're right. And the repression that we felt by the police was really a traumatic thing to see. I mean, it changes your view of how the country works when you realize that something that is illegal to do, like going onto the street and expressing protest, all of a sudden becomes randomly illegal because the cops say so, because, you know, the mayor decides that they're going to shift tactics. And I saw people grabbed and arrested and head beaten and all that, for exercising their rights. And then it became, like you said, a very specific strategy of repressing and snuffing out the movement. And laws were passed. I forgot the name of that law that Obama passed. It was essentially an explicitly anti-Occupy law. So they've definitely, you know, it was a very big lesson in state repression. However, the cat is out of the bag in terms of changing the culture. I think that basically people don't believe that the markets are and the 1% are looking out for them anymore. And people don't believe that anymore. And you can see that in this election. But I think that right now, 2016 is a very it's a difficult and interesting time because the culture has changed, but the hard power has not changed very much. In fact, it's gotten worse, right? Yeah. I mean, today, if you look at the New York Times front page, you're going to see a article about a Wall Street firm called BlackRock. Now, BlackRock is basically the largest financial firm in the world, and almost no one knows about it. It's like something like $5 trillion that they're handling. And this is a firm that essentially the founder sort of created the derivative, one of the people that created the derivative in the 80s and 90s. Then that crashed, and then essentially mopped everything up in 2008, made a partnership with the government, and actually really expanded precisely during the crisis, and is now in a position of power that people are having a hard time even comprehending.
Yeah.
Because they're using technology in all different ways. So that's just to show that, Occupy happened, but in a very structural way, things have, in a lot of ways, gotten worse since then and more consolidated.
Yeah, I think, Noah, you're absolutely correct.
So we have to, basically, it's a long haul, and we have to keep pushing.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much, Noah. We got to move on here.
Thank you, Noah.
You're absolutely correct about BlackRock. They are the financial core, of the transnational capitalist class. They're the largest trillion dollars worth of assets that they're managing. And there's just a few people that are making these decisions that impact all of our lives worldwide. So very important for you to understand that. We also want to thank you very much, Noah, for your involvement here. And we want to move on to a short clip from the DVD Heist, Who Stole the American Dream, which is kind of the history of why we got to Occupy and all the manipulations of deregulation that allowed corporations to run wild.
Under Reagan, the mandate agenda included not only deregulation of Main Street industries, but the financial industry as well. This set the scene for a future disaster on a scale previously unimaginable, starting with the hundreds of savings and loan bankruptcies of the late 1980s.
The financial razzle-dazzle that 30 years later takes down the economy really starts when Wall Street starts inventing all kinds of new gimmicks, and the regulators give all this stuff a free pass.
Everything has rules. You know, baseball has rules right down to how many stitches are on the baseball. And when you remove the rules, you enable people who behave badly. The purpose of rules is not to regulate saints. It is to deal with people who are sinners.
Once Wall Street was deregulated, their profits mushroomed. Large commercial banks like Citicorp watched with envy. And in the mid-1990s, they too began fierce lobbying to get their slice of the pie.
In 1933, Congress passed a law called the Glass-Steagall Act. And that law said, well, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure out if allowing banks to invest in speculative securities brings down the banking system when the market fails, then maybe we shouldn't let them do it.
It was very simple. It maintained that commercial banks that were responsible for individuals' deposits and savings and lives were kept separate and were backed by the government from the more speculative, risky trading activities of the investment banking community.
It worked so well that people forget. And in 1999, a genius by the name of Phil Graham, aided by a brilliant president named Bill Clinton, who signed the bill, and pushed by a free market ideology that had been peddled to the United States people since the day Ronald Reagan was elected, said, we don't need Glass-Steagall anymore. We haven't had bank panics.
Glass-Steagall was the longest-lived and most successful financial law ever passed, protecting consumers and investors alike. Within a year of Glass-Steagall's repeal in 1999, President Clinton signed the deceptively named Commodity Futures Modernization Act, deregulating shadowy financial products known as derivatives. One of those instruments, known as the credit default swap, became the prime culprit in the 2008 worldwide financial crisis. The head of the Federal Reserve Bank at the time, Alan Greenspan, endorsed these changes, giving the green light for Wall Street to once again become a casino.
Was Alan Greenspan was an extreme conservative, and there was a period, you know, in the 90s when Greenspan was widely praised as this genius, and he got out just in time. He got out just before the crash, and his policy of deregulating everything and financing all of this speculation with very cheap money, that's going to look a lot worse in light of history than it did at the time.
He wanted to give Wall Street really a gift at the time, which was cheaper money, which is why he cut rates.
And all the speculators take advantage of the very cheap money, and they invent a whole bunch of new toxic stuff like subprime. In the last 10 years, something crazy happened. The multiple of the value of housing to people's incomes went through the roof. And that was a classic case of a speculative bubble. And this was engineered on Wall Street.
Because there was so much trading, there appeared to be demand for mortgages, which meant it appeared there was a demand for homes being sold, which inflated the actual cost of homes. There was some sense that, well, maybe even if it goes down, we won't be the last company holding the ball.
Wall Street paid their chief executives hundreds of millions of dollars for screwing us up and losing our money. And we paid them a huge premium for this. We said, boy, these are really smart guys. They're not smart guys. You and I would never have made those loans.
Where do you think you made a mistake then?
I made a mistake in presuming that the self-interest of organizations, specifically banks and others, was such as that they were best capable of protecting their own shareholders and their equity in the firms.
The consequences of this mistake are huge. Again, it wasn't accidental. This wasn't just random delusion. It was prevalent because so many people were making so much money. As soon as the casino goes bust, they want government to bail them out. Now, that's not a free market. That's socialism on the downside and capitalism on the upside.
If Greenspan and Rubin had really believed the ideology that they preached, they would not have bailed out the SNLs the way that Greenspan did. They would not have, Rubin would not have bailed out the Wall Street holders of Mexican bonds in 1995. Greenspan would not have bailed out the stock market in 2000 and 2001. The only explanation I can have for this is that it's a class question. These people were protecting their class. And what class was that? That was the class, global class, the network of financial wheeler dealers who had essentially dominated the world economy.
You're listening to the DVD Heist, Who Stole the American Dream? And it reveals how American corporations orchestrated the dismantling of middle-class prosperity through rampant deregulation, the outsourcing of jobs, tax policies favoring businesses and the wealthy. The collapse of the U.S. economy is a result of deliberate choices made over 35, 40 years by a small group of leaders, leaders of corporations and their elected allies in government and their lobbying interests in Washington and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The collapse is not a catastrophe. They made lots of money as working people in this country really got messed over badly. And that, of course, led to the Occupy movement. It continues to lead to social movements around the country because this is not over, folks. We are still controlled by people in Wall Street and people in the government who believe greed is good and believe in that philosophy. And you can prove that wrong right now by saying greed is not good. And you can make a donation to KPFA and support this radio station, support our efforts here by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or online at kpfa.org. And we have to thank a donor from Bridgeport, Connecticut, who made a donation, and from Oakland and from Albany. We can see the online ones here, and we know that lots of you are phoning in right now. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. This is time now to say no to greed and open up your pocketbooks a little bit for whatever you can. I mean, even a $60 pledge $5 a month will get you, as a thank you, the Occupy Movement documentary, The American Autumn. $100 pledge will get you the DVD Heist, or both together for $150. That's like $10 or $12 a month on your credit card. We need your help. We would like you to make that kind of effort, to make that contribution, to say no to greed, say yes to Occupy, yes to the 99%, no to the 1%. And we're going to figure out ways to tax them and re-regulate the massive profits that the banks and others are getting, like BlackRock, the one that Noah talked about in the interview. We think this is vitally important, and we ask for your support. So, Michael you're here now. Let's talk about kind of your overall impression. You are very involved in the Occupy movement, and you continue to write and edit Occupy.com, which is available online for people to get updates on that. So tell us what your overall impression is.
I mean, my impression, boy, it's not a year of political optimism, that's for sure. This election has pretty much...
That's the truth.
Yeah, to say the least. I think Americans are overall pretty apprehensive about right now and about who's going to step into the White House, regardless of who it is, and who's going to control Congress, regardless of who they are. Everything's pretty dysfunctional and unpredictable and up in the air. And I think that Obama had his movement. Occupy occurred under Obama's reign. And I got to say, he got off with a pretty light slap with that. He got a nice movement. And unless things change, I think that things are building and coalescing. And what Occupy did was allow all Americans of all walks to come out to find their place, what matters most to them. You mentioned earlier, I mean, if you're about healthy eating, maybe the GMO movement was your movement and fighting against Monsanto. You know, maybe you were in that. If you're about health care, making health care accessible to all was yours. If you're about minimum wage, I mean, 2012, 1 year after Occupy kicked off on September 17th, 2011, 5 years from tomorrow, you know, months later, the Fight for 15 movement was born in New York City, and workers making minimum wage across the country saw a new opening. And now we've seen what happened. They shut down hundreds of fast food stores and other chain franchises across the country. They've done that numerous times. That movement's only growing. That's one more sign of an empowerment that Occupy gave birth to. And, you know, I say it was Obama's movement. It was disaffected Obama voters. It was young people who did believe in hope and change, who went and elected Obama and saw the results 2-3 years later, who essentially came out and kicked off Occupy. What Hillary or, God forbid, Donald, whoever is in the White House and whatever government is in power, they're going to have something wholly different on their hands for the next presidency and for this next administration if some real changes don't occur, because what Occupy did was show that people aren't sitting quietly and taking it any longer.
Well, they're not sitting quietly, and as we know from the polls, in both parties, the majority of the people are unsatisfied with their candidate. So that's an election for the minority, really, and we're not going to stop. We're not going to be quiet. We're not going to shut up. KPFA is going to stay on the air. We're going to keep you informed about what's going on, but you have to help us in that effort. You have to give us a call at 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or go online at kpfa.org and make that pledge right now. It's a $60 pledge, $5 a month, and you can get this wonderful American Autumn DVD, an Occupy Movement documentary. For a $100 pledge, you can get the DVD, The Heist, Who Stole the American Dream, understand that history, or get both of them together for a $150 pledge. We ask for your support. We really need you to call and support KPFA to keep this station alive and healthy and engaged in the kind of political and social justice realities that are happening in America today and the world. And so we ask you for your support. This is a Project Censored show. I'm Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff will be back next week. Michael Levitin is here, and he's an Occupy activist and a good friend of ours for a long time, as we asked him to come in and help today. This is all volunteer, folks. We are here to help you have a better understanding of what's going on in the world today. And we ask you to say no to greed and support us in that effort to say we support the 99%. We support the efforts of KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. 800-387-5732. Online, kpfa.org. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Call us right now. Michael?
Yeah, I fully back Peter's endorsement. Do call 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You know, KPFA was on the scene, I think, in the earliest days of Occupy. I can't think of another media outlet that would be earlier to jump in and document a movement that was growing from its infancy. And I think it's been on the front lines for every movement, you know, from Black Lives Matter to the current one right now, Standing Rock Sioux movement to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. I think that the movements in which mainstream media is not doing its job, covering it, letting us know early and loudly what is happening and why it's happening, and who's pulling the strings of power, really, in social and economic justice issues, KPFA does.
And certainly KPFA was live in the Occupy region in Oakland as that was happening. They were very much live when the ports were shut down here in Oakland with the marches, tens of thousands of people involved, and certainly watching the police repression and the organized stormtroopers, I can't think of another word, the way they came out in the big black covered, you know, riot gear. It's scary. But you stand up, you say no to that fear. You know that you're right. You know that you believe in this. And you know that greed is not good. And help us out here, folks. 1-800-439-5732. We've got a minute left in the show. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Donate online at kpfa.org. Two premiums, the American Autumn Occupy Movement documentary for $60, the DVD Heist, the American Dream for $100 pledge, both DVDs for $150 pledge. We really ask for your support. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks today to our producer, Anthony Fest, and our engineer, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on 35 stations across the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time. Liberated land supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaigns. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rainbow. You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. Michael Parenti, Superpatriotism and the Importance of Being Number One. What does it mean to love one's country? Why is it important to be number one? In this sharp and funny speech, Michael Parenti dissects the uses of patriotism. That was the introduction to a Michael Parenti talk given in 1988 at the end of the Reagan administration. That talk became a TUC radio program and 2004 book published by City Lights. Super Patriotism, How Hype, Fear, and Mindless Flag Waving Are Supplanting Informed Debate and Commitment to Democracy. Now, in 2016, so many years later, slogans such as America First, America the greatest country on earth, are having a powerful comeback. Resistance to superpatriotism, even if it is simply remaining seated during the national anthem at a sports event, can draw a hateful response from those who Parenti was concerned about a generation ago. Michael Parenti received his PhD in political science from Yale. He's the author of 23 books and many more articles. His works have been translated into 18 languages. He grew up in an Italian-American working-class family in New York City. His PhD from Yale would have guaranteed him a career in academia. He knowingly gave up that chance when he openly opposed the war on Vietnam and was arrested. He decided to become an independent author, lecturer, and activist. Here's Michael Parenti in 1988 in Boulder, Colorado, recorded by KGNU Radio.
Thank you very much. It's a very special pleasure to be here and to see a lot of very nice people in the Boulder political community. The title of the talk is Super Patriotism, Real Patriotism, and the Importance of Being Number One. Well, as a guest on radio talk shows, I have on a number of occasions criticized U.S. foreign policy, and one time an irate caller called in and he said to me, do you love your country? And the question was obviously rhetorical, because here was someone who saw fit to question my patriotism because I was questioning the policies of our leaders. That's really strange when you think about it. The caller was manifesting a symptom of what might be called super patriotism, also sometimes called stupor patriotism, also called pseudo-patriotism, a phenomenon best defined as the willingness to follow our leaders uncritically in all their dealings with other nations, especially when those dealings are confrontational and belligerent and they involve a question of national pride or the use of military force. That's the definition of super patriotism. This super patriotism or American chauvinism has been with us throughout much of our history. And whether or not it's the last refuge of scoundrels, as Dr. Johnson would say, it certainly is a very effective instrument in discouraging and discrediting critical public discourse. Well, I think it's time that the super patriots account for their brand of patriotism and explain to us what it's all about. For instance, what do they mean when they say they love their country? What do they mean by country? You know, academia is not totally without certain virtues. You learn to ask a lot of trivial, detailed questions in any case. So I asked myself, what do you mean by country? Do they love every region and locale in the United States? Well, obviously, very few of us have been to every region and locale. Does love of country mean loving the American people? Well, again, even the most gregarious among us have met only a relatively small portion of the American people. And I would bet that these super patriots don't particularly love whole sectors of the American public, especially the more bigoted super patriots. In fact, rather dislike to associate with or have any positive identification with certain people because of reasons of ethnicity, religion, race, and class. Do super patriots love America for its history and culture? Again, I'm really skeptical of that because it's my impression that they know very little about American history and culture, or rather, much of it is rather unappreciated by them. Furthermore, there's a terrible side to our history that's really not all that lovable. For instance, the extermination of American Native Indian nations, the enslavement of African people, the aggressive wars against Vietnam, Mexico, Canada. We lost 1,000 men on one attack on Canada, I just learned a little while ago. Central America, the Philippines, and elsewhere. Nor might we all be that enamored with certain aspects of American culture, certainly not the mind abuse of primetime television, the commercialism, the corporate greed, the ecological devastation, the economic and racial injustice. If I'm being asked to prove my patriotism by loving American popular culture, then I might fail the test, I guess. Well, the America that the super patriots claim to love is neither a geographical totality, nor is it a vast population, nor is it really a history or culture. As far as I can see, their America, when they say love America, is an ideological abstraction. It's an emotive symbol that can be embodied in other abstract symbols like the flag. It's a sort of almost a love without content. I mean, how else can you love a flag? I mean, a flag, as you know, is a piece of rag on a stick, and it's got colors and things. Well, having said that, let me contradict myself, because there is one real content to the super patriotism. Its main substance is militarism. The pacifist and political scientist and activist, by the way, good pacifists are not passive, they're pacifists, and they're quite active. The pacifist and activist, Milford Sibley, he once noted, quote, "Patriotism for most professional patriots seems to be inseparably connected with military violence and war." Indeed, the most militaristic among us seem to think that they are the most patriotic. Isn't that rather extraordinary? Patriotic virtues are equated with military ones. Our history's patriotic vignettes are usually military ones. Valley Forge, the Alamo, Gettysburg, the battleship Maine, Pearl Harbor, raising the flag on Iwo Jima, D-Day, the MIAs and POWs, and the like. Our country, right or wrong, but mostly our country at war or ready for war. The commemorations of our national leaders during national holidays would be incomplete without the marching troops, the weapon displays, martial music, formations of fighter planes zooming overhead. Even in local communities, when they organize patriotic celebrations, they usually appear the marching bands in semi-martial uniforms, the high school cadets with rifles on their shoulders, and if there's an army base nearby, even troops. I remember once sitting in Urbana, Illinois, standing there July 4th, watching this parade come by, and on this float was suddenly this missile, sort of small missile, but there was this instrument of death on this float that was going by. And there were some people around me, and you know what they did? They started to applaud this inanimate object. I mean, there wasn't even a pilot or, you know, somebody else tending to it, or a soldier striding it and waving and going, "Yow, look at me," you know. I mean, it was too much for me. They were just applauding this weapon. And then a little jet fighter came by on the float, and they started applauding that, too. This was at a time when these things were being used in Vietnam. Even July 4th fireworks are really a benign representation or replication of the rockets' red glare, the bombs bursting in air, as the top patriotic song on our patriotic hit parade goes. Max Weber once said that the state's irreducible characteristic is a monopoly on the legitimate use of violence. And to be sure, state ceremonies in most states include some display of military force. Now, the way super patriots express their national pride leaves me uncomfortable. It seems the love we are to have for our country rests on some kind of competition with other countries, that it comes at an expense with other countries. It's a love that is predicated on some invidious comparison to other countries being lesser, being not as good. If we love our country, we have to believe it's better than any other. The super patriots will even ask us, "Don't you think this is the best country in the world?" So that you love it because it's better. This, by the way, we might recognize immediately as the being number one syndrome. I guess I must have heard about being number one for a long time, but the first time it ever stuck in my mind was when I heard President Richard Nixon sometime in the late 60s announce, and I quote, "America is still number one." The still, of course, you know, hints at some anxiety that there might be some slippage there. So I'm listening to this and I'm saying, okay, number one. But I was bothered by it because it presumed that we were in some kind of adversarial relationship to other nations, all other countries, and that somehow our greatness and our goodness could only be measured in comparison to them, only in our ability to be the top banana. And then one of those troublesome questions came again in my head, and I said, if we're number one, what are we number one in? I mean, what are you number one in? So I thought, I said, population? And then, no, the Chinese walk away with all the awards in that category. Geography? No, I think the Soviets and even Canada has more real estate than we do. We're not number one in size. I mean, Brazil is a number of countries, I think. I don't even want to think about it, about all the countries that might be ahead of us there. Steel production and other basic industries, I perked up a little. Well, we used to be number one in that, but we have slipped down the list because our super patriot corporate leaders have taken to abandoning our communities and exporting our jobs and bringing the factories off to Taiwan and Argentina and South Korea, where they can work for slave labor wages. Which, when you think about it, is not the way for super patriots to act, really, you know, take our factories away and all that. I was sitting there saying, well, what are we number one in, you know? And the best I can tell from the super patriotic utterances is that it gets down to two things. One, wealth. With no concern as to how the wealth is distributed and how it's used and for what effects. And military power. With no concern, again, with how that military power is used and for whose interests that it might serve at home and abroad. Now, supposedly, we can love America and be proud of our country because it's so great. The implication is, however, that if it weren't so great, it wouldn't be so lovable. And that began to trouble me. The super patriot's love of country seems predicated on the countries being up there, stronger and superior to other countries. What happens if it's going to slip? What happens? I started thinking, what about people from lesser lands, as we might call them? I mean, what about somebody from Luxembourg? I mean, now Luxembourg is number 122, you know. I mean, just barely ahead of San Marino in its military might. I said, what does someone from Luxembourg do? Do they go around shamefaced like this, you know? You say, you from Luxembourg? You from Luxembourg? I say, no, I'm French. No, I'm French. And you say, do you love your country? You know, they say, well, what is there to love? I mean, a few border police, no army, no navy. I mean, it's a... The super patriots were exhilarated by the U.S. aggression perpetrated against Grenada. To them, such military exploits are an affirmation of our nation's strength and worth, and therefore their own individual strength and worth. I mean, there's people who went around who really got off on the invasion of Grenada. Ronald Reagan, the conqueror of Grenada, reflecting upon his greatest military victory, hailed the venture as an example of how the U.S. defends democracy. This preoccupation with being number one strikes me, ladies and gentlemen, as I say, as a sign of weakness, not of strength, as a sign of insecurity, not of security. A people who know who they are don't worry about being number one. A people who are in touch with the deeper values of social justice and democracy don't get a number one thrill from stomping on a tiny nation. A people who seek friendship and cooperation with other peoples don't need to lord it over other nations and outshine them. Such a people don't have to find reassurances in themselves by looking at or imagining the deficiencies of others. And they don't feel threatened by the accomplishments and strengths of other people. The state is no longer there to serve us. We are here to serve and glorify the state. The state becomes an entity, a force unto itself, a powerfully abstracted symbol that claims our ultimate and total loyalty, a moral object, a moral entity in itself whose existence and growth are taken as self-justifying. You know, a question could be raised. What's so important about the state existing and growing and continuing and expanding and flourishing, whatever else? That's taken as self-justifying. In fact, that question would be considered unpatriotic. The moral code that applies to nationalism does not operate the same as the moral code that applies to individuals. The premises that governs all individual morality is that your behavior must at some point lead to self-restraint and even self-sacrifice. In individual morality, there are certain things you should not do, even if they're convenient, advantageous, and whatever else. Even if you have the impulse for them, even if they advance your self-interest, you must not do them. That's what the whole essence or code of individual morality is, as in thou shalt not. These premises are inverted when applied to a nation's behavior, and they often lead to terrible and untrammeled excesses. The nation-state is something more than human, and there lies the power of its appeal. At the heart of the super-patriotic ethic is the belief that the nation's existence and its actions are so endowed with virtue as to place it above the commonplace rules of life. The restraints that apply to ordinary humans don't restrain the nation. So convinced of its supreme virtue, the nation knows no other restraint than the limitations of its own self-interest, its own desires, and the limitations of its own power. Ladies and gentlemen, the difference between individual morality and national morality is a very real one. When the aggrandizing individual commits an evil or harmful act, there's some sense that he is to be punished, he or she, or should be punished. At least some questions raised about whether proper standards of conduct haven't been violated. But some of the most outrageous acts, which would be outrageous under an individual moral code and unsupportable in civil life, are applauded as heroism when performed in the name of the nation. Thou shalt not becomes thou shalt do anything by any means necessary if it can be said to be in the national interest and if it serves national security. Well, who are the super patriots? They can be found in high and low places. They can be found in the White House, and they can be found in your local American Legion post. But super patriotism, I would argue, is not a product of mass psychology. It's not a product of mass macho psychology as such, although it certainly appeals to machismo, often resorting to a kind of John Wayne approach to foreign policy. The suppliers, the pushers of super patriotism, most conspicuously are our top political leaders, our publicists, our media pundits, our institutional heads, including some college presidents and corporation leaders. Super patriotic ideology is assiduously propagated by the ruling class of this society. But ideas do not float around in social space. You see, there's no such thing as just an idea around, like a virus. And so with ideas are mediated through social structure, through social organization, through a social system, that is through organized statuses, roles, groups, families, schools, communities, media, other institutions, whatever else. And some ideas then are mass marketed. Some ideas are taught to us from day one in those little flag salutes we have at school. One of the key functions of super patriotism is to blur the differences in class interests in our society and try to convince us that we're all in the same boat, rich and poor alike. You, me, the Mellons, the Morgans, the Rockefellers. In truth, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, on almost every issue, we the people are not in the same boat with the big financiers and companies. The costs of our policies are not equally shared. We pay the brunt of the costs. The benefits of our policies are not equally enjoyed. We don't get much of that. There's a case where you have to have a class analysis rather than a flag-waving analysis. This is equally true of ancient empires as well as modern empires. In 1919, the conservative economist Joseph Schumpeter, he described the imperialism of classical Rome in words that might sound familiar to present-day Americans. Quote, "That policy which pretends to aspire to peace but unerringly generates war, the policy of continual preparation for war, the policy of meddlesome interventionism." He's writing in 1919 about ancient Rome. "There was no corner of the known world where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under attack. If the interests were not Roman, they were those of Rome's allies. And if Rome had no allies, then allies would be invented. When it was utterly impossible to contrive such an interest, why, then it was the national honor that had been insulted. The fight was always invested with an aura of legality. Rome was always being attacked by evil-minded neighbors, always fighting for a breathing space. The whole world was pervaded by a host of enemies, and it was manifestly Rome's duty to guard against their indubitably aggressive designs. They were enemies who only waited to fall upon the Roman people." Now, in contrast to the super patriots, it begins to brighten here. Real patriots love their country enough to want to improve it, and their patriotism has a social content, and that social content is social justice. Real patriots do things the American way, the democratic way, not with secret crypto-fascist coteries in the national security state, but with open debate and open challenges against privileged interests. Real patriots know that democracy is not just the ability to hold elections, but to serve and fulfill the basic needs and interests of the demos, the people. Real patriots are also internationalists. They may love and feel attached to their country, but they also love the peoples of all countries, all being different representations of the human family. Real patriots find different things in our history to be proud of than the super patriots do. We're proud of things like the struggle for the enfranchisement, the abolitionist movement, the peace movement, the abolition of child labor, the struggle for collective bargaining, the extension of universal suffrage to people of color and to women, the struggle for racial justice, the eight-hour day, occupational safety, the struggle for gender equality. We need change. We need to tax the rich and not the poor. We need to restructure the use of energy to save the environment and ourselves. We need a health insurance program for the 35 million Americans who are not covered. I mean, isn't that amazing? Isn't it time for an investigation? How could that be? How did that come about? Why? We need people who not only bemoan these things, like the liberals say, isn't it a shame, the homeless? Isn't it a shame, not enough adequate health care? Isn't it a shame? You have to stop complaining about that. You have to start asking, but why does that exist? What are the forces that allow, in the richest country in the world, these kinds of terrible inhumanities and inequalities? The airwaves of this country, ladies and gentlemen, are the property of the people of the United States. That may come as a surprise to some network bosses, but it's true. And those airwaves should be opened up. There should be public access television. We need exposure to a socialist perspective. We need exposure to various dissident perspectives in the mainstream media. And we need discussion of worker-controlled enterprises and public ownership. We need a national debate in the mainstream media on the oppressive, unjust purposes of U.S. foreign policy in the Third World and elsewhere. We need to re-examine our institutions, our schools, our colleges, hospitals, museums. We've got to find out why all those institutions, our media, why they are all dominated by self-selected boards of trustees or regents who are answerable to no one but themselves and who control all spending, all hiring, and all other policies. We need a government that has the capacity to go directly into not-for-profit production. If private industry can't provide the needs of the people, if the utilities can't give you electricity without jacking up the rates every year, jacking it up again and again, then take it away from the utilities and the people themselves can do it themselves. If private industry can't build us homes and hospitals and get jobs, then let the public sector do it. There's all these people who need work. There's all this work that needs to be done. There's all this capital that can be used to do it, and none of it's come together because there's no profits in it for the Morgans and the Rockefellers and the DuPonts. So then let the public sector do it, not for profit, and it will get done. And when it gets done, it creates social income, it creates private income, it expands your tax base, it creates public income, and it creates more opportunities for growth. The danger with that, the danger is not that it won't work, the danger is that it does work. And that's why they stop it, that's why they want privatization, that's why they sell off Conrail at one-third its actual value, because Conrail under public ownership was working, and those railroads under private ownership were milked like cows, milked and run down, and then they turn around to the government, they turn around to the taxpayer, and then they go socialist after they've milked it down and it's about to fall apart, and they say, we can't run it anymore, you're going to have to take it over. And the taxpayers take it over, and they dig deeper into their pockets, and they pay for it, and they put it back on a working basis, a rational basis, a not-for-profit basis, so that the money it makes goes back into it and doesn't go out to the George Bushes and the Ronald Reagans and their class. And then when it works, Ronald Reagan says, we got to sell this thing. And he sells it not because it wasn't working, but because it does work. We need to open up our political system, ladies and gentlemen. We need to have new parties, not just two capitalist parties, not just two anti-communist parties. We need to have proportional representation so that if a minority party wins 11% of the vote, it gets 11% of the seats. We need funding for minority parties. We need free TV time for minority parties. We on the left are second to no one in our patriotism. We want fundamental restructuring and democratization of overseas and domestic policies. We want restructuring and democratization of the political process, the values, institutions, the economy, and the class power of this country. We real patriots say, along with Albert Camus, I want to love my country and justice too. And in fact, I believe that the only way you can be a real patriot is to love justice. Because you can't be patriotic to something that's unjust. We want to spend less time trying to save the world with bombers and battleships and more time healing ourselves. This is not just a good idea or a noble pronouncement. It is a historical necessity. This country does not belong to Ronald Reagan and his billionaire friends, although they act like it does. It belongs to us, and sooner or later, we will take it back. Thank you.
You heard excerpts from a talk on superpatriotism by the internationally known writer and lecturer Michael Parenti. He is one of this country's foremost political analysts and the author of over 20 books. This timeless archival talk was recorded by KGNU Radio in 1988. And the election campaign of 2016 brought back the memory of this early TUC radio program and the book published by City Lights in 2004. Michael Parenti, Superpatriotism, How Hype, Fear, and Mindless Flag-Waving Are Supplanting Informed Debate and Commitment to Democracy. If this sounds important today, please pass on this free speech. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The concept of I'm right and you're wrong is increasingly prevalent during the macro governmental political struggles. How to identify the narcissists in our lives is the topic of this archive edition of Radio Curious in our 2015 conversation with Joseph Burgo, PhD. He's the author of The Narcissist You Know, Defending Yourself Against Extreme Narcissists in an All-About-Me Age. Once a narcissist's behavior is identified, it's possible to learn how to coexist and avoid being trapped without compromising one's own mental health, integrity, or ability to succeed, or losing ourselves in the process. When Dr. Joseph Burgo and I visited by phone from his home in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado on October 5th, 2015, we discussed two of the eight most common types of narcissists, the bullying narcissist and the seductive narcissist. We began our conversation when I asked him to describe narcissism.
Narcissism is really a spectrum of possible behaviors and psychological profiles. It's healthy self-esteem at one end and narcissistic personality disorder on the other. I think the people that I'm talking about, the extreme narcissists, they are not born, they are made by particular environments that they grow up in. I like to say that extreme narcissists are in flight from themselves, usually from a sense of core shame or defect or ugliness or deformity. It's the result of a childhood that departs dramatically from what you might normally expect, where, for instance, there's a severely depressed or psychotic mother, where there's violent discord in the household, where there's physical violence, where the father abandons the family, where a parent dies. It's a gross departure from what Donald Winnicott called the blueprint for normality. And what this leaves behind is this feeling of core shame that I talk about. And in response to that, extreme narcissists build and defend an idealized false self-image that's meant to disprove all that shame that they feel. They really view the world in terms of winners and losers. They do whatever they can to prove that they are winners, often by triumphing over or defeating other people that they despise, the losers. And in the process, they rid themselves of this feeling of core shame by really forcing somebody else to carry it for them.
So to be clear, it's not a genetic factor. It's a social cultural factor.
I think it is not a genetic factor.
How does this differ in other cultures? You're basically looking at the North American United States English language culture. Is that right?
I am. It's a fascinating question. And, you know, I'm not a sociologist, but I think you see similar dynamics in what are called shame cultures or honor cultures, where public face and reputation are zealously defended, and to lose face is deeply humiliating, so much so that you might want to kill yourself. I think it's a similar dynamic where there's some kind of shame that is felt to be intolerable, and if you can't preserve face, if you can't defend this public image, then you know you want to eradicate it in some way. I do think there's a parallel between these types of cultures and the individual psychology I'm talking about in my book.
So you talk about a joyful parent-child interaction that develops a stability as a basis for avoiding a narcissistic behavior?
Yes. Now, I think that in the earliest months, maybe the first 2 years of life, to have parents who adore you and take joy in your presence, that's a normal, expectable experience. That's what Winnicott would have said is in the blueprint for normality. But then I think a little bit later on, there's another job that parents have to undertake, which is to curtail grandiosity, to at first make their children feel that they're at the center of their emotional universe, and then to teach them humility, a respect for the rights and feelings of other people, to find one's place in the social order. And if you don't do both of those things, then things can go seriously awry when it comes to narcissistic development.
So let's look at a young person up to the age of 5 or 6, and events then. You talk about the positive aspects of joyful interaction with the parents, but also there's trauma at every level. Some it's a gross tragedy. And going back as adults, not knowing what happened to each of us during those first 5 to 7 years of life, can you talk about the effects of that in relationship to a narcissistic behavior in an adult?
How does it relate to the overall experience of feeling safe and loved in your world? Is there enough of the latter experience to compensate for the former experience? Is there, on balance, more love, safety, and security than there is trauma? Now, in my experience with people that I have worked with, as well as some of the famous people that I talk about in my book, there was some major trauma that was either ongoing, let's say, as in the case of, say, Lance Armstrong, or there was a major traumatic event, say, the loss of a parent early on. Those kinds of traumas where you lose a parent long before you're ready to deal with it can be deeply, deeply scarring and formative Madonna, for instance, lost her mother at a very early age, and she says, and everybody who knows her says, that it shaped who she was. Several of the people I talk about were put up for adoption early on, and people who know them will say it shaped who they were. If there is this kind of early trauma, you can spend the rest of your life building and defending an idealized false self that's meant to disprove what you feel about yourself, that you're damaged, that you're unlovable, that you're broken in some way.
Let's stay with adoption for a moment. You talk about the maternal bond developing prior to birth. In an adoption situation, whether it's an adoption right at birth with new parents, a new mother with whom there is no maternal bond, and undoubtedly no breastfeeding, how can a person address those issues in their adult life, particularly if they relate to narcissistic behavior?
It's a very painful thing. I think that for some people, the trauma of having been put up for adoption shapes them for life, and in certain ways, they never get over it. Even if they were adopted into reasonably good families, I hate to sound pessimistic. I think it is formative. I think it's a lasting scar. That doesn't mean that they can't lead happy and productive lives, but there's a kind of pain. There's a kind of shame, what I would refer to as core shame, that is the result of feeling that you weren't worth holding on to. Even if you understand that your mother might have had very good reasons for putting you into a better home, there's just a feeling that if you were worthy enough, if you were lovable enough, she would have found a way to hang on to you. I think that dealing with that kind of lasting scar is something for psychotherapy. I think it's something that you have to take up over a number of years through in-depth psychotherapy.
So in another factor related to removing a child from the home, from the Child Protective Services Agency's point of view, the children want to be with their parents. So again, we potentially have a rupture that would manifest behavior later in life.
It's a case where neither option is good. It's really very sad. I mean, as you say, children just love their parents because, and they attach to their parents because. It's just the way we are when we come into the world. So they want to hold on to their parents, even if they're very bad parents. And if you remove children from a very bad situation, it's traumatic, even if they go to a better home. So sadly, you know, neither option is a really good one. One is better than the other.
So in your book, The Narcissist You Know, Defending Yourself Against Extreme Narcissists in an All About Me Age, you have several categories of extreme narcissists. Are there any particular traumas or experiences in early childhood that would lead a person to be a narcissist in one category versus one of the other several categories?
I think so. I think that the more traumatic the early background, the more neglect, the more violence there is in the household, the more likely the person is to develop one of the more toxic kinds of extreme narcissism. And I think if I put them on a spectrum, I would say that the two worst kinds are bullying narcissism and vindictive narcissism. If you think about core shame as an excruciating sense of internal defect or unworthiness, of ugliness, of deformity, the worse it is, the more you want to get rid of it, and the more violent will be your methods to force it onto somebody else as a way to escape from it yourself. This is the dynamic in bullying narcissism, where the bully will identify a victim, the loser, persecute him or her as a way of forcing that person into the role of loser and to carry the projected or offloaded sense of shame. And it can be quite violent. In vindictive narcissism, these people can spend a lifetime trying to destroy people who they feel are the source of a narcissistic injury. So I think the worse the trauma, the worse the form of narcissism.
Destroy people who cause the narcissistic injury. Are you saying they take a different person than the actual one who caused the injury early on in life?
No, what I'm saying is that each subsequent narcissistic injury will revive and reactivate the early trauma. So say, for instance, you are an extreme narcissist who has been married, and then the spouse decides to divorce you. Being rejected, being divorced, is felt like a terrible narcissistic injury that revives all those feelings of unworthiness, like you're not worth holding on to. And especially in divorce cases that turn ugly, you see incredibly vindictive behavior, where the worst, of course, is when the children are used as weapons in a vindictive divorce, where one spouse tries to turn the children against, you know, the other spouse. But there are other things, like trying to get the other person fired, or trying to turn everyone in your social world against the other person by spreading, you know, vicious and unfounded rumors about them to destroy their reputation. These things can go on for years and years and years.
So in addition to the marital separation, divorce circumstance, this can present itself in public presentations. Do you find that to be an appropriate comparison?
I do. The stronger comparison I see is in workplace bullying. You often see people who are quite vindictive in the workplace, and for some slight that you can't imagine, you can't understand why the person is offended, or simply because you're better liked or you pose a competitive threat to the person, someone can then spend a lot of energy trying to get you fired, trying to destroy your reputation. Especially if it's your boss, this can be very damaging to your career. I present a profile in my book about someone who was basically driven out of the workplace by his vindictive boss, and then the boss tried to keep him from getting hired ever after by giving bad performance reviews whenever someone called for a reference.
So this could occur within the workplace or by someone going into another workplace from which they have been expelled and being vindictive in that manner?
Exactly. You know, these people are relentless, and they will do everything they can to destroy you once you become a target.
Well, I want to ask you about the other kinds of narcissistic behavior, but before we get there, I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Joe Burgo, Ph.D., the author of The Narcissist You Know, Defending Yourself Against Extreme Narcissists in an All About Me Age. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Joe Burgo, let's talk about the other forms of narcissistic behavior.
I describe many different types of narcissists in the book, from the very familiar and not quite so dangerous know-it-all narcissist. This is a person who is immediately recognizable to everybody who's listening, you know, the type who monopolizes conversation at dinner parties and other social venues, who always seems to know better than everybody else, who has a very skillful way of turning the conversation back to him or herself if it ventures too far astray. We've all met these people. They're social bores. Usually you can avoid them. You know, you might humor them and then, you know, politely excuse yourself. We've talked about the bullying narcissist and the vindictive narcissist. Another type that might be familiar to people, one who operates in a slightly different way, is the seductive narcissist. Unlike the other types of narcissists I profile, who try to make you feel like a loser to build him or herself up, this one tries to boost your self-esteem. They build you up. They make you feel like you're fascinating and attractive. But it's all so that you will feel the same way about them. It's all about wanting to get you to admire them and be attracted to them. And it lasts about as long as your uncritical admiration for them lasts. Once you start to find fault with them, you can find yourself moving very quickly from pedestal to trash heap. And there are other more familiar types, like a grandiose narcissist. This is probably the most familiar type to people, someone who just thinks he's the center of the universe and exaggerates his accomplishments, takes credit for other people's achievements, just thinks everything is about him.
Joe Burgo, in looking at your book, there's elements of extreme narcissistic behavior that you discuss that I would think that most every person who looks at it would identify with at some level or another, not necessarily extreme, but elements in their own behavior.
Exactly. One of my goals in writing the book was to show how narcissism is really a spectrum phenomenon, and that we can best understand the extreme narcissist by understanding our own narcissistic tendencies and how they show up. There's a tendency in modern psychology and psychiatry to attach diagnostic labels to people that put them in categories that make them seem entirely other from the rest of us. Narcissistic personality disorder, that's those obnoxious, offensive people who are nothing like me. My goal in writing the book was to say, no, wait a minute, we're actually all narcissistic from time to time. The difference is that these extreme people embody these behaviors and defensive maneuvers we all use on occasion. They do it permanently. It's built into their character, and they're relentless. That was a big goal in the book. The other goal was really to show how, because of the way extreme narcissists try to make us feel like losers, they try to tear us down to build themselves up, we can best understand and cope with them by dealing with our own self-esteem issues. So, for instance, if you're targeted by a bullying narcissist, you might feel like you want to stand up for yourself. You know, you're being made to feel like you're inferior, and you might want to fight back. This is a dangerous undertaking, because if you challenge an extreme narcissist, particularly a bullying narcissist, he or she will simply escalate the attack. It becomes Armageddon in a way. So you have to learn how to manage your own self-esteem issues, hold on tight to your own self-esteem without having to attack the other person, and figure out ways to manage the other person's ego without making yourself an even larger target.
And some examples of managing yourself without making yourself a greater target?
Yes. I give an example in the book of my encounter with a know-it-all narcissist who really got under my skin. And, you know, I reacted in some ways that I later found kind of embarrassing, like I wanted to put her down, cut her down to size, which only forced her to, you know, to keep talking. The bullying narcissist is the better example, where I give an example of someone in a workplace who really tried to stand up for himself when his boss started targeting him, and he went to human resources. He tried to stand up for himself, and this resulted in him being labeled a problem employee. It resulted in the boss trying to get him fired, and ultimately he was so demoralized and beaten down by the experience that he became depressed. He started having sleepless nights, and eventually he just had to quit his job. So fighting back is not the best technique.
However, you do have an example in your book of someone who did a similar thing and laid out a significant array of evidence about the bullying narcissist.
This is the thing. You have to have the evidence, because bullying narcissists, other kinds of narcissists in the workplace, are often very good at disguising their behavior from everybody else. They can be, model employees when it comes to their superiors, and a nightmare for you. So you have to preserve all of those toxic emails. You have to protect your own work product. If you can get other people to bear witness and sign witness statements to the bullying behavior, that's on your side. See, the problem is it usually comes down to his or her word against yours, and whoever has the evidence is going to win.
So in those situations, we have the private attack from a bullying narcissist versus the public attack.
It's a toxic situation, and it's very hard to cope with.
Well, Joe Burgo, in addition to having the evidence, how does one cope with it?
The most consistent piece of advice I give in the book is that whenever possible, get as far away as possible. I know that sounds cowardly and simplistic, but these people rarely change. They rarely go for treatment, and going up against them is frequently a losing proposition. So if you can, get a new job. Sometimes that's not always possible. So you have to recognize that shame, this kind of excruciating core shame, is the issue, even if you can't see it. You have to kind of imagine your way into the other person's inner world, because everything they're doing on the outside disguises that feeling. And you have to do nothing that's going to stir up shame. Again, it sounds kind of cowardly, but managing the other person's ego is part of your unwritten job description. It's a big job, and it's more than I think many people can manage. It's best to move on if you can.
So moving on is total disconnect and go on with the rest of your life.
Absolutely.
So then let's stay with trying to get into and understand the other person's life.
It's useful to think about extreme narcissists as ego-inflated and as dangerous as they might seem as toddlers on an emotional level. That's about where they are. So if you can think about that you're dealing with a child rather than a fully mature adult, that might give you some insight into ways to cope with them. Just as you have to do with toddlers, you have to be very clear on limits. You have to set appropriate limits and make clear what the consequences are going to be. Unfortunately, if you're dealing with these people, they don't like limits any more than toddlers do, and you're likely to get an enraged response. It might help you to develop some empathy for them. This is the biggest challenge I present in the book, is to try and develop some feeling of empathy for what these people actually feel about themselves on an unconscious level, so that you don't feel the urge, the understandable urge, to retaliate and hurt them back in the way they're hurting you.
How do you get that information?
One way of doing it is to do a little research on the background of bullies that appear in the news. I did that. It was very helpful to me to talk about a lot of the cyberbullying cases that have appeared in the news recently, or school bullying. There's been an anti-bullying movement that's underway. When you take a look at the background of the people who bully, it's not a happy story. You know, they come from very damaging backgrounds. A lot of family turmoil. They were often abused and bullied themselves when they were younger. You know, if you want to do a little research into the background of the bully, you'll soon find out that they're in some ways very sympathetic because they've suffered a lot already.
Well, Joe Burgo, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, the questions that I like to ask. Can you tell us about an aha or eureka moment that has shaped your life?
Yes, I can. I think the most painful one, but the most formative one, was the moment in my life when I realized that I was trying to make my life look perfect from the outside, like I had it all together, and that I was in flight from shame myself. It was the moment where I really began to understand narcissism and the kind of shame that lies behind it.
What shame were you flying from?
I came from a pretty dysfunctional family with an absentee father and a narcissistic alcoholic mother, and I spent many, many years in analysis. I wanted to make my life look post-analytic and normal, and the truth is I bear the scars of my childhood just like anybody else who had one like mine. So bearing those scars in mind, bearing my handicaps in mind, helps me to function in a better way, in a more empathic way, but I'm not by any means completely over them.
How is it going for you?
Much better since I stopped pretending that I was perfect.
And tell us, Joe Burgo, what would you like to do with the rest of your one precious life?
I've never wanted to do anything other than be a fiction writer. I started writing fiction when I was 12, and I would like to feel that as I gain in reputation, I can also publish novels and other kinds of fiction that are very psychological in nature. I'd like to bring the two halves of my life together, my career as a psychologist and my career as a fiction writer together.
What's keeping you from beginning the fiction now?
Nothing. In fact, I have a book I'm bringing out myself in the spring. It's three very psychological fairy tales in which I apply all of the ideas that I've written about in this book to Cinderella, Snow White, and Rapunzel to talk about shame and narcissism.
And that brings us to the final question. Is there a book that you can recommend to our listeners?
When I was doing my research in narcissism, I read a lot of books, and the one book that I felt really captured the kind of dynamic I was trying to talk about is a book called Why Is It Always About You by Sandy Hotchkiss.
Joe Burgo, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Joseph Burgo, Ph.D., is the author of The Narcissist You Know, Defending Yourself Against Extreme Narcissists in an All About Me Age. The book he recommends is Why Is It Always About You? The Seven Deadly Sins of Narcissism by Sandy Hotchkiss. This program was recorded on October 5th, 2015. Radio Curious has over 600 archive editions on our website, radiocurious.org, with new editions published regularly. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnested and Yuko Kodama are the assistant producers. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.